the What I Watch Tonight show.
Good morning, afternoon or evening, wherever you are in the world, and welcome to the first ever episode of the Movie Quarter from What I Watch Tonight. My name is Matt Hudson, and joining me is my very well-dressed, super smartly groomed, Uber Dude co-host.
Hey everybody, my name is Cody Curtis. I'm excited to be here with Matt. If you don't know me, I'm from YouTube. You can just find me by searching Cody Curtis. And you know what? We're here to talk movies. We're here to talk movies in the first quarter. And you know what? We've had some pretty fantastic films within this first quarter of 2018. We've also had some stinkers too. But you know what? Matt and here, we're here to talk about every aspect of these films, what we think about them, and some recommendations that we're going to give. And you know what, Matt? I'm super excited to get started. So why don't we just jump right in?
Well, let's do it. Well, as Cody mentioned, the Movie Quarter is a show where we pull together and we discuss the major releases for every quarter during the year, be it theatrical and streaming, because we've got to give Netflix some love sometimes. So, Cody, let's do it. Jump right in. Can you deliver January's list, please?
Absolutely. The films that came out this January and the films that we're going to talk about in the month of January are Insidious: The Last Key, also known as Insidious 4, The Post, The Commuter, 12 Strong, Molly's Game, and Hostiles. Now, to jump right into this, let's start with Insidious: The Last Key, also known as Insidious 4, also known as Insidious, the biggest pile of horror movie crap I have seen in a long time. Honestly,
I'm so glad you said that.
Yeah, honestly, look, guys, if there's one thing you need to know about me, I'm a giant, giant horror movie buff. I'm fairly recent to watching and loving horror movies. I didn't start really getting into them until probably 2014. My first introduction was The Shining with Jack Nicholson by Stanley Kubrick. And I have loved the Insidious films. I mean, 1, 2, and 3. 3, I think, is okay, but 1 and 2 in particular, I'm a big fan of. I'm a giant fan of James Wan, and you know what? James Wan stepped out of the picture. He's an executive producer for this particular film in the Insidious series, and it's understandable why.
Yeah, this was not good at all. I totally agree, and I was kind of hoping that we didn't start off with a massive argument. I'm glad you feel the same, but this is dragging the franchise out too much now. I think the first two, like you say, were very good. The first one especially. The third one was okay. This one though, the story's cluttered. You've got flashbacks, abductions, a family reunion, astro projection, an ending which seems to stop and seems to start back again, demon hauntings and whistles, strangely enough, and none of it works at all.
No, which, you know, it's funny because, you know, demon possessions, the astral plane, all of this stuff is material that's been, in essence, a major part of the Insidious franchise. Yeah. And a lot of people, myself included, when Insidious 3 ended, a lot of us were like, you know, here's the thing, the third one, it was just okay. But one thing we can't say is that Insidious is a great horror movie trilogy to watch around Halloween. It's a good set of movies. And then Insidious 4, The Last Key, which, you know, personally for me, I'm glad that in all of the marketing, they never actually said Insidious 4 from what I saw. So I don't include Insidious, The Last Key to be part of the Insidious franchise, because I feel it's not this way when you get extra films tacked on to franchises, but Insidious: The Last Key is one of those very rare films that is so bad that it's not even included in really anything that's important to the rest of the Insidious trilogy. And like you said, Matt, just every aspect of this movie flopped from head to toe.
Yeah, but by the time the ending came about, which was a ridiculous revelation at the end, I was just exhausted, and I'd lost interest long before. It just seemed as if the writers had run out of steam and were kind of just making it up as they went along. And I feel sorry for poor Lynn Shay, the mainstay of all four films, because she tried her best, but this is just one to avoid.
I mean, yeah, it really is. And I mean, Lin Shaye, she's the best part of the movie. That's what you can say. She was the best part.
Yeah, and when the best part of the movie doesn't include any of the demons, and one of them's called Keyface. Just let that sink in. The best parts of this film were when, I thought, were when the nasties were actually out of the picture. And it was just Lin Shaye doing her thing with the family members and the rest of the cast. It's when it started to delve in more into the horror is when I thought it actually fell apart, which is a shame for a horror film.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So are you going to recommend Insidious, The Last Key?
Absolutely freaking not.
Yeah, what a good start. I am going to join you. I am absolutely not going to recommend this film. The next film, though, The Post, may be slightly different. Finally, we had Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep on screen together, directed by Steven Spielberg and scored by John Williams. It was like everything that could possibly be wonderful about the cinematic universe came together, and I liked it. I thought it was a pretty solid movie. It's very decent retelling of a watershed moment in US history, or journalism history, I thought.
Yeah, it was. And one thing I can say about the The Post. And one thing you guys might notice is that there are a couple of Oscar nominated films on here, and The Commuters, and there we go again. The Post is
two
one of
massively
them.
Different films.
Yeah, absolutely. The Post. Look, Steven Spielberg, he is personally, I think, the best director working today, because he's gone through so many genres of film, and Tom Hanks is one of his staples when it comes to the movies he produces. And, you know, Tom Hanks, Meryl Streep, you have, and Bruce Greenwood's also in there.
Yes.
And this is an all-star cast that is in The Post. One thing I will say about it is that when it comes to Spielberg's biographical films that he makes, be it from Saving Private Ryan to Lincoln to now The Post, most of these kinds of films, they're not like his other films. They're not like Jaws. They're not like Jurassic Park. They're not – Spielberg, obviously, he is paying respect to the events that happened. But there are certain films that he makes, especially The Post, that they're either going to be good or they're going to be great. I mean, I don't think Spielberg, when it comes to the biographical picture he makes, he doesn't have one bad film in there. And what I'll say is The Post – The Post, for me personally, I thought was very much like you, Matt. I thought it was a solid film, although I thought the dialogue was pretty nicely written. I thought the music was great, as always, because John Williams is – he's a music god. Yes. But this movie, there are some parts of it I don't think were all that special. And I mean, it's a biographical picture, so there are some things that may or may not be expected. And I think it was mostly in the first act, it was a little hard to get started. For me, the first act was a little bit more convoluted and it was just trying to find its footing at the very beginning.
Yeah, I think the better moments for me surrounded Kay Graham, which is Meryl Streep's character, and the pressure and decisions that fell her way as the film went on. So the ear whispering from the assertive male colleagues to not publish these bombshell papers for the fear of reprisal against her and her family. So that, if you don't know the story, the actual true story, this film may be even better for you. If you do know the events, then, you know, it's a kind of by numbers retelling with some liberties taken. But in terms of just the film itself, it does get a lot better as it goes along. Yeah, the first, you know, third of the film is fairly tough going, I'd say. But it also has Michael Stuhlbarg in it as well, who's on an absolute hot streak at the minute.
Yeah, he is. He really, really is. And look, when it comes to movies like this, I always enjoy watching them, even if they're a little bit slower or a little bit rough to start out. Because these kinds of films, be it this or a film like Hacksaw Ridge or a film like Bridge of Spies, which Spielberg also directed, it gives me some material. So even though this is a baseline telling of the story, it makes me want to go and do research and find out more about what actually happened during those events.
Yeah, and Spielberg has made a story which is a sensational story, but on paper probably could look quite bland. But with the talent, it's Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep, the talent he has on show, he manages to elevate that source material into something very watchable. It does have a rough start, but by the end of it, I was impressed enough. Was it a Best Picture nominee for you, though?
No, I don't necessarily think so. I think The Post is a good movie, but if we're going to talk about a movie that I believe is maybe not more Oscar baity, but a film that has more power, has greater performances, has a lot more to say about humanity in our current state, there's actually two. Number one is Blade Runner 2049. I mean, I will hold to this day that I think Blade Runner 2049 should have been nominated for Best Picture, but I don't think enough people saw it. Number two, which I'm not exactly sure why, but Logan was not nominated for Best Picture. And, you know, Logan is exactly the kind of film that the Academy loves. It's a little indie film, even though it's based off of a series of comic books. And it has Patrick Stewart and Hugh Jackman, in my personal opinion, give their absolute best performances they've ever given in their career. And it's just one of the most tragically powerful films that I have personally seen within the past 10 years.
Yeah, I certainly agree on Blade Runner. Not that I disagree with Logan. I definitely agree on Blade Runner, because you quite rightly say that not enough people saw it, because let's face it, not enough people saw that film, whether they were put off by the runtime, by the lack of knowledge about the original, whatever. But that film was spectacular. Logan, on the other hand, was a film which I wasn't expecting too much from, to be honest. And then when I saw it, I realised what an absolute idiot I was, because it was awesome. Like you say, Hugh Jackman starting in, 2000 as Wolverine, and evolving into that character. It's an amazing career path he's taken, and he is brilliant. And like I say, Patrick Stewart is superb. And I am surprised that Patrick Stewart wasn't put forward for a potential Best Supporting Actor nomination, even if it was just a token nomination, because we know the Academy isn't hot on comic book films, but at least it did get that screenplay nomination, which is still big news.
Yeah, it is big news, which, you know, that is actually something I find really interesting, is the fact that it did get nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay. You know, it's how the words are translated to the screen, but it didn't get nominated. You know, here's the thing. Words are just words on paper when it comes to films, until you have an actor who can bring those words to life. So that's the one thing I find a little bit confusing, is the fact, especially since I was in theater for quite a few years. And if there's one thing that my theater instructor taught us on a continuous basis, and the film classes I'm taking now, is that you can have the greatest script in the world, but if you don't have great actors to back up what's on those pages or put their own spin on what those words mean, then the words don't mean anything when it comes to film. And I have to believe that's true. And that's why it saddens me that Hugh Jackman did not get a best actor nomination, because, you know, we got actors like Daniel Day-Lewis, and then we also got who else?
Denzel Washington.
Yeah, and if you ask me personally, I would have taken Denzel Washington out of that category, and I would have put Hugh Jackman in. But, you know, with all of this stuff aside, I think we need to revert it back to The Post, which, once again, it has really good performances. It's a solid biographical picture, and it might be something that spurs you to go on and do your own research about this time in American history. So for me personally, even if you only see it once, it's a high recommendation for me, just because it's Spielberg.
Yeah, Spielberg, Hank Streep, John Williams. To get it, may not be the greatest film ever, or may not have been the masterpiece people wanted for finally having those two titans on screen together, but it's a good film. So again, if you only see it once, which I probably only will ever see it once, it's recommended to go and see it, just to see these four absolute maestros working together on screen, on score, on direction. So yep, I give this one a recommendation.
All right, next up, guys, we are going to talk about The Commuter. The Commuter, also known as Nonstop on a Train.
So, Liam on a train.
You know, Liam on a train, Liam in a plane, Liam chasing down his daughter, or Liam going against Rome. Let's talk about this guy. Liam Neeson, nobody's going to deny the guy's a great actor. I mean, he was, speaking of Spielberg films, he was in Schindler's List, yes, for goodness sakes. And he was... gave one of the most emotionally powerful performances he's ever given. And, you know, now that he's getting older in age, you know, there must be something a little lethargic, something that feels really good about being that old guy who can just mow down a bunch of people and not have to worry about being taken down. Just for those people who want to be better as they get older, watch Liam. What I'll say is, for me personally, I do like action films, and action films like this, I did get some enjoyment out of. I mean, Nonstop was a film that I enjoyed, and The Commuter is in that same ballpark. Yeah, and I do realize Commuter's not going to be for everybody because it is a film. It doesn't do anything special. The script is pretty horrific, in my opinion. But, I mean, it's filled with really, really cool action scenes. It's got a slow pace, and it's got a little bit of a mystery to it. And in my opinion, it's a movie to where if I'm really, really bored on a rainy, rainy Saturday night and it's on cable, I could probably watch it again.
Yeah, this is the first film of the episode to be labelled with the tag of it's just fun. It's dumb fun. It's Liam Neeson on a train, this time taking people down as he searches for one particular passenger. And it would almost be stupid to try and pick this film apart and pull out its raging plot holes and inexplicable acts of the one man wrecking ball, Liam Neeson.
Let's face it, that'd just be way too easy.
Exactly. It's a film about a man who can go from being a fired salesman to leaping from trains, taking on men half his age and negotiating life and death hostage situations. Apparently, they also quickly mention he's an ex-police officer, but he must have got a hell of a lot of training. And crucially, a guitar is used as a lethal weapon, and that's the best part of one of the best parts of the year for me.
Yeah, it's good. There's a lot of scenes like that in there. Me personally, I like to think there are some connections from films like Run All Night and Nonstop and The Commuter. Mm-hmm. I like to think that Liam Neeson is like Jason Bourne, to where he'll get his mind erased after each movie ends, and then he'll just be put in a new spot with a new life, be given a new identity, and he thinks he's that person. But somehow he always retains the amount of skill. Because here's the thing. No matter who Liam Neeson is in whatever movie he's in, he still has the same set of skills that he had in Taken.
Yeah, very particular set of skills, I'll have you know.
Yeah, very particular set of skills. So, I mean, I don't think there's really much to talk about this movie. It's a simple, dumb action movie. And if you're somebody who enjoys simple, dumb action movies or action movies, I mean, I won't recommend it to everybody because not everybody's going to like it. But I will recommend it to people like me who like this kind of thing.
Yeah, if it has got a mystery, if you're paying attention for the first 20 minutes, you'll probably unravel it quite quickly. Yeah. But if it's action and a bit of excitement you're after, just throw logic out the window and just enjoy it. Because when you do that, it's not actually that bad. Whisper it quietly. It's not that bad of a film if you just sit down. Like Cody says, rainy Saturday evening, just grab your popcorn, whatever is your sin, and just watch it, and you'll probably find you enjoy it more than you should. So on that basis, I would recommend it for that kind of lazy weeknight or weekend in film.
Alrighty.
So, going on, it is now 12 Strong, a movie that came out in January, which had a very good ensemble cast, I thought, together with each other. And I think quite boringly, the best way I can describe this film is it's serviceable. It was okay. Is that the best way I can put it, I think, really? It wasn't bad. It wasn't great. It was just there.
Yeah, this is where you and I are going to slightly agree. I think this film is kind of overrated. Mm-hmm. In the worst way possible. I watched it. I did enjoy some aspects of the film, but what I took away from it was this is literally the best Call of Duty movie that we've ever had. Yeah. For me, I like the performances. I understood the message they were trying to get across, but it was long, it was boring, it was dull. I didn't really care about any of the characters. I mean, you're set up with the characters about 5 minutes into their screen time. And look, I understand they're trying to do that so you understand what these characters are fighting for. But for me personally, I would have liked a little bit more buildup with these characters, because it's like, oh, you see them with their families. Now they're off to war and they're off on their journey. And the story is amazing. I mean, if this is one of those movies where I said in my review of it that it wasn't exactly my thing, and I was bored out of my mind for a good portion of it. But it is one of those movies that I do recommend people still see for the sake of what the story is.
Yeah, I agree. The story itself is a story that needs to be heard, because at the end of the day, it is the heroism and obviously sacrifice of what these guys do for their families and for their country. So, hallelujah, it's a story that people need to hear. The film, it is, yeah, with the cast it's got, I mean, it's got a good, it's what, a Chris Hemsworth, Michael Shannon, Michael Pena, Trevante Rhodes, just to name, Austin Stowell's in it, just to name a few. It's certainly got the talent there, but yeah, it just meanders a bit too much, and it, for me, it fell into the category that the heroes were portrayed as too heroic, and the enemy, the villains, the Afghans, were just a bit too foolish for my liking, considering their sort of feared status for what they are. So,
well, I'm not going to disagree with you on that.
Yeah, that it kind of a bit too cliche for me. So it was an okay film, average at best, I'd say.
Yeah, I'm with you there. It was average at best. And you know what? Speaking of a movie that is not average at best, in my personal opinion, that is Molly's Game. And I'll tell you one thing. I'll tell you and this is another one of those Oscar bait type movies. There is two particular reasons why this film is as good as it was. Number one is Aaron Sorkin's writing, and Jessica Chastain.
Yes.
Jessica Chastain, look, we already got the news that Jessica Chastain is going to be in It Chapter 2, and
That's awesome.
If you guys don't know anything about me, I'm a little bit of a fan of It. It's one of my all-time favorite books. I'm a giant Stephen King fan, and It Chapter 1 from last year is one of my favorite films of last year. It was either number 3 or 4 on my list of my top 10.
I think I had it as number 6.
Yeah, I mean, it was so good. But Molly's Game, on the basis of the writing. Now, this is one of those films where I only saw it once when it was in theaters. I remember enjoying it quite a bit, quite a lot. And Aaron Sorkin's writing was fantastic. The only thing that I had a problem with Molly's Game is that I feel the third act may have been a little bit too rushed. Like, this is one of those movies, the dialogue was so good. And the editing in it was, I mean, the editing was okay. I did feel that it jumped quite a bit throughout scenes. But this is one of those very rare films where, you know, it was 2 hours long. I would have liked it to have been about 2 hours, 2 hours, 45 minutes, because I think one of the opportunities that they missed on was the whole poker aspect of it. I mean, it's one of those things where you see the character, you see how she loves this game and all the inner workings of how she started her empire. But I actually want to see them get down to the nitty gritty of the game a little bit more.
Yeah, you took the words out of my mouth regarding the third act. It didn't grip me as much as I'd hoped. It all fell into place a bit too quickly and a bit too conveniently. But I can't disagree with Jessica Chastain. She absolutely smoulders in this role. She is fantastic. If anyone sort of wanted to see why she is considered such a good actress, just watch Molly's Game, because she holds that film up by herself. We've just spoken about films with, if you have somebody else in the role, would it have been as successful? Jessica Chastain is one of the main reasons this film is as good as it is. Somebody else in that role, she may not have been able to handle it as well as somebody as good as Jessica Chastain. Also, Idris Elba, I thought he was fantastic. He was almost as good in the parts that he has. Mm. But regarding the dialogue, ironically, I found some of it to be slightly bulky and at times a bit too. It was too heavy, too wordy at times, which is ironic because Sorkin is such a fabulous writer. Mm. But for the other 95% of the film, the writing was on point. So it's a film about poker. It would have been great to see a little bit more poker. But what we did get, I felt, was a very good realisation of the game itself. So I don't know if you play poker, but
I haven't had the chance to. You know, maybe some, like, on the side with some friends, but not legitimately.
Yeah, same, yeah.
But one thing I forgot to mention, it's not just Aaron Sorkin's writing. This is Aaron Sorkin's directorial debut.
Of course,
once again, In my opinion, I think as far as a directorial debut, it's not as good as Jordan Peele with Get Out. It's not like Greta Gerwig with Lady Bird, but I still think this is quite a solid opening number for Aaron Sorkin in his directorial world. He did a very, very good job. Now, the best thing about this movie, without a doubt, is Jessica Chastain. I thought the direction was good. I thought the writing was great. But Jessica Chastain, without a doubt, is the person you see this movie for.
Oh, absolutely. I think a lot of other directors would be more than happy to have Molly's Game in their own canon as their fourth, fifth, or sixth movie. And this is Sorkin's first film, so whilst it isn't without its issues, like you mentioned, the editing is slightly choppy at times, and the pacing can be slightly awry. For it, you know, it's almost patronising to say, but for a first effort, I mean, it's certainly not a bad effort whatsoever.
No,
you mentioned obviously Lady Bird and Get Out; they're on a different plane. But Money's Game isn't a million miles behind. Maybe it needed that extra 20 minutes or 40 minutes, like you said, just to really flesh out the story and really hit home the rise of her empire and just give the characters a bit more to do other than Jessica Chastain. But then again, more Jessica, I'm not going to complain about that. So for the most part, very, very good film. It surprised me because this isn't one which I had on my radar. I knew it was coming out, but I wasn't, you know, particularly interested in rushing out to see it. And then the buzz started, and then I went to see it, and boy, am I glad I did.
Yeah, and guys, if you could not tell by the way Matt and I are talking about this, this is a highly, highly big recommendation from both of us. So if you haven't seen it, either go to Redbox or go somewhere where you can rent the movie or buy it if you want to do that sort of thing, and sit down and take the time to watch it.
Yeah, absolutely. Take the time, turn the lights down, and just lose yourself in it, because we recommend it, and I think you guys may enjoy it as well. Whereas the next film, this is a bit more of a mixed bag. The next film, and the final film in our January list, is Hostiles.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, it's kind of, like I said, it's a mixed bag. It is, because Christian Bale is superb in the role, and like a lot of other people have said, he could have snuck into that Best Actor nomination as well for this role. But because the film did fly under the radar and come out very late, I think that may have been part of the reason why he didn't get in. This has an absolutely brutal introductory scene, this film does. If you are weak-hearted, it may affect you, because it is a tough watch, this first scene. And there are many action scenes which don't pull any punches. So it's violent, it's raw. But at the same time, it's quite slow and ponderous. And I know it's purposely meant to be. It's not meant to be an all-out action film, and it didn't need to be. But at times, you know, for stretches of the film, not an awful lot happens. So for me, it was either plodding, it was exciting, meandering, or sadly at times, quite boring, I thought.
Yeah, no, once again, we agree. Me personally, you know, Christian Bale, Rosamund Pike, all the performances all around were great. They did justice to what they were trying to do. And I am very, very glad that this film didn't pull any punches, especially with that introductory scene, because this film accurately portrayed the brutality that was between America and America's people and the Native Americans in our country's past. I mean, knowing the brutality of what was going on, you know, learning about through history or watching films, learning about that, they did do all that brutality justice. However, you are absolutely right. With all the brutality and the excitement that comes with the action scenes, because the action scenes were very, very well put together, the movie is very, very boring. And it's sad to say so, but there are a lot of slow-moving scenes, scenes that make you sit, ponder, and think about what's going on. But then there are still those kinds of scenes, except take the ponder aspect out of it. It's just slow moving for the sake of being slow moving. Nothing really is making you question your humanity or question the world that around you. It's just, you know, characters are walking and you're just watching conversations unfold, but they don't exactly have any impact.
Yeah, and I don't want to speak for Cody when I say this, so whether you agree or not, but I don't need a film to be crash bang wallop and full of action. I love a slow film more as much as I love the scary films, the action films, the comedies.
I'm with you there.
Slow film, whether it's a drama, period drama, as long as the story is captivating, it can be as long as it wants to be, as long as I'm drawn into the story. With Hostiles, that was the problem, is that for a story, as you mentioned, as important as this, I just didn't feel drawn into it. Christian Bale's character was very good, but and Rosamund Pike as well. But aside from that, they're sort of interspersed with these kind of very frantic action scenes. Sometimes not an awful lot happened, and it just kind of made me... That's what took me out of the film more, kind of thinking, well, I understand we're meant to be sort of drawn into this world and in the character's shoes somewhat, but it didn't work for me, unfortunately, this film. So it's a mixed bag for me.
I mean, I don't think we can disagree on this. I mean, I do like action films, but as we've both discussed, that neglecting action for the sake of story is one of both of our favorite things. I mean, one of our favorite films, I know my personal favorite film from last year and my favorite film of all time right now is Blade Runner 2049.
Yep.
For that very reason, is Blade Runner 2049, if people say they don't like Blade Runner 2049, I understand it, because the film is, it's close to 3 hours long. The film is very, very slow moving, but it's supposed to be. The film is based all around story and scenery and messages and all that stuff. And if a film does that right, then it's beautiful. I mean, another film, say, like Lady Bird, you know, it's a coming of age story. It's completely slow moving. I love Lady Bird. It's a very, very slow burn-esque film in a look at life. Hostiles, although it tried to do that slow burn thing to try to apply messages, it's a very mixed bag. And it's one of those films where if they had tried to either put more messages or try to make more captivating dialogue, I would have been there. But the film, for the entirety of the second act, I gotta say that it was just so boring to me.
It's a shame, and that intro scene, Christian Bale's performance, and the major action scenes in it, I don't think they're going to be enough for me to hope to honestly want to recommend this film to anybody. And it almost pains me to say that, because when it's good, it is good, but there's too much of it which just isn't compelling enough. Where and just throwing back your BR 2049 example, spot on, because that film was also purposefully very long, pondering at times, but the story demanded it and the story drew you in. Whereas with Hostiles, I didn't get drawn in by the story, even though it clearly attempted to do that. So for me, it's a no recommend.
Yeah, I once again, we agree. Hostiles, it could have been some. This is a film that is such a shame, because it had all the potential in the world, but in reality, I can't recommend this either.
So for January, we both don't recommend Insidious. We do recommend The Post. We do recommend The Commuter. If you're, yeah, we're both doing it now. It's that film. We do recommend The Commuter for one of those kind of fun evenings. Get your pals around and watch the film. 12 Strong, no. Molly's Game, we did. And Hostiles, we didn't. So January in itself is also a mixed bag.
So for January, that's out of all of them, there's only three films that we really recommended.
Yeah. But to be honest, yeah, and one of them was a kind of, like, yeah, get a pizza, watch The Commuter, and just kind of forget life for an hour and a half, and then forget the film.
I'll tell you.
Recommendation.
I mean, I'll tell you, though, I'm excited to move into February, Matt, because something tells me with this first film, I am going to get very passionate and very heated. So, guys,
and not in the way the film wanted you to.
We are moving into the month of February, and this was not only an exciting month, but for the most part, this was the January of this year. So the films that we've got, are 50 Shades Freed, Black Panther, Winchester, The Cloverfield Paradox, and Mute. Now, 50 Shades Freed.
You first.
Fifty Shades Freed. You know, it was some masochistic, sadistic thought process that I must have had, because, you know, I, up until this year, I had never seen any of the 50 Shades of Grey movies. And, you know,
lucky you.
I thought to myself, you know, these films, they cannot be as horrible as everybody's saying they are. And you know what? They're worse. They're so much worse than everybody. Okay, here's the thing when it comes to the 50. I'm not just going to talk about 50 Shades Freed here, because the movie is laughably bad. That's what I'll say. Yep. It is laughably bad. I am going to come crashing down on the entire 50 Shades of Grey saga. And here's the reason. It's the reason why I hated all the Twilight films. If there are any girls or women listening to this podcast, if you honestly are going to watch any of the 50 Shades of Grey movies and look at that and say that's a healthy relationship and that's the kind of world that you need to belong in, then I don't know what to tell you. Because honestly, the relationships that I see in the 50 Shades of Grey movies, they are the most abusive, most horrendous, most awful look at relationships that you can possibly have. And it was the same thing with Twilight. You have this girl who is very, very submissive. And, you know, if her boyfriend gets angry or husband now gets angry at her for one little thing, she gets all quiet and all afraid and she won't stand up for herself. And, you know, oh, if she does something that he doesn't like, then he's going to punish her and make sure that she doesn't see the light of day. You know, here's, you know, it's not just the fact that these movies are bad. It's the kind of message that they send out there. I mean, sending a message that having a dominating, controlling relationship is healthy, it's disgusting. And honestly, I wish the 50 Shades of Grey books and the movies had never happened. Number one, because they're awful. Number two, because they're just sending the wrong messages out there. They're disgusting, they're despicable, and they should have never been made.
I think once every 3 months, we're going to enter a little zone called Cody's Crazy Corner, where he absolutely lets rip on one film every quarter. For this one, it's 50 Shades Freed. And yeah, absolutely right. The film is garbage. I think the majority of people probably guess that. The messages are poor, and especially when we get to the end of the film, and I don't care about spoilers of this film because it's crap. You get to the end of the film and they try to portray Christian Grey as this really nice kind of family guy who's, you know, and I think it's actually his mother actually says, you know, he's a really great guy. And you think, well, hold on. The three films before that have basically been showing what an absolute dick he is. Yep. But, and now at the very end, where people have actually managed to sit through it all, we're meant to believe that this big crybaby, essentially, he actually is a really nice guy and he has other people's interests at heart. It is horribly written. It's a bad a repetitive story. And the two lead actors desperately trying to bring some kind of earnestness to their utterly hapless roles. It's tensionlessness. There's sort of strangely edited sex scenes, which kind of bookend every scene. And there's no passion to them whatsoever. And there's a few times during these kind of instances where I did have a good chuckle. And like you said, it's not in the way the director would have wanted. But sometimes it is just so laughably bad that you can't help but just giggle at what you're watching. So I guess from that side of it, I actually had a really good time because it gave me a good laugh, but not how James Foley, who also did 50 Shades Darker, would have wanted. And I guess this film does follow the trend set by Grey and Darker by being absolutely abysmal.
Yeah, you know, the interesting thing is, I don't know if it's the case with this film, but I did hear a rumor that during the filming of 50 Shades Darker, they actually fired the screenwriter because the author of the book didn't like the way he was writing it. And the husband of the author of the 50 Shades Darker book actually wrote the script.
You're not wrong. E.O. James became an absolute dictator on the film because she didn't want the film to deviate from her source material.
And you know,
which in one sense isn't a bad thing. But when the source material is a bad thing, then it becomes a problem.
You know, that's the awful thing. And, you know, if creators want to have control over their material, I'm perfectly fine with that. But the fact of the matter is, when it comes to I never thought I would ever say this, but it's the case with every movie that comes out. You know what? There is probably some universe where if E.R. James, if she had no control over any of this, You know, the 50 Shades of Grey films, they probably could have been decent movies with decent plots and decent...
I'm glad you said that.
I mean, there is a possibility that they could have been good. But just this whole control... Like I said, this is the problem I had with the Twilight films. And it's the fact that this whole message about controlling relationships and domination... And look, I know... There are people who are into that whole domination things, people's kinks in the bedroom, you know, all of that stuff, that's their business. But when a film is so different because film presents a message, film is one of those things where it actually presents a message that it wants people to apply to their lives. And sending a message out there that a little bit of submission, and if you're not following what your man says, then you need to be punished. And, oh, guess what? A dominating BDSM relationship. That's healthy, guys. Guess what, folks? Whoever is listening to this podcast, here's the reality of the situation. It's not healthy. It's very unhealthy.
What can you say to that? Because... It's true. And I'm glad you mentioned a point about the story itself, because I've mentioned in, I can think off the top of my head, two of my previous podcasts I've done with people where they've also ranted about how awful these films are. But I've kind of held dear that somewhere in this story, in this overarching narrative, is a good story. Deep down somewhere, there is going to be a story there worth telling. However, you know, like we said before, having a story and the execution of it are two different things. So I do agree that there is a story in there somewhere to mine and to actually make fairly decent. I still don't think it would have been anything short of just okay, but anything could have been better than what we were presented with. If you like the first two movies, then this will be right up your alley. You'll love this film. If you didn't, then I can't build on what Cody said because there's nothing more to add because... That's just how it is, you know what I mean? Everything the YouTube movie dude said is spot on. If you didn't like this film, you won't find anything to enjoy here.
No, you won't. And you know what's funny? The sad part of this is we're going to get into this down the road, but there's a film on our list that we're going to talk about that I feel is a much better version of 50 Shades of Grey and ultimately what I think 50 Shades of Grey should have been. But with that aside, you know what? He's right. Matt is absolutely right. If you like these movies, then that's up to you. Fine. Movies are subjective. Go ahead. Have your fun. Watch away. But for everybody else, do not spend the money. Do not watch this movie. It just don't. But on that note, what I want to move on to next... Up until a certain other film that came out this year, this was my favorite film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And that's Black Panther. But you know what? I ranted about 50 Shades Freed. Matt, you take it away with Black Panther.
I'm certainly not going to rant in a negative way about Black Panther because this film was awesome. The social revolution that Black Panther created cannot be understated and it shouldn't be underestimated either. What Ryan Coogler's vision of this futuristic African nation with its proud heritage and tradition, it gave a chance for a long overdue chance for this insanely talented cast to blaze a trail as the stars of a huge blockbuster. Just as crucial as that is the fact that the film delivers on nearly every level and it's a contained story. For people out there who haven't followed the MCU and this movie made an insane amount of money, so I don't think it's out of the realms of possibility to think that not everybody who saw this film has seen the previous 17 MCU installments, but it felt like a contained story that didn't fall back on the world's going to end, we need a hero. You had T'Challa, this sort of vulnerable yet proud king, leading Wakanda, finding this threat of the fantastic Eric Killmonger. Michael B. Jordan was superb in this role. Where do you start with a film like this? I've said before that in terms of comic book films, I'm very fair weather. I usually watch them and then I don't dive into the lore or anything like that. I just watch them for what they are, good films generally. But this film surprised me because I really, really got sucked in by this film. The visuals, the sound, the drama, the excitement, the emotion, Martin Freeman's accent and haircut, everything I loved about this film. But that's me. How about you?
Yeah, I absolutely, like I said, when it comes to Black Panther, up until a certain other film that came out this year, this was my favorite film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And it's a hard, here's the thing that I find very interesting, is that this year, I believe it's this particular year, we've had not one, but two films that have crossed the $200 million mark. Black Panther was one of them. Opening box office, of course. Black Panther was one of them. The other one, I'm sure that we will talk about in a future episode of this podcast.
Yes, absolutely.
But Black Panther, Ryan Coogler, I mean Fruitvale Station, Creed. The guy is a... You know, the guy is... I believe that he's not even 30 yet, and he's made a career for himself in film, creating some of the – first he creates Fruitvale Station, a very, very powerful movie. Then he creates Creed, which in my opinion is the best film since the first Rocky film that we've gotten. And now we've got Black Panther, and I know a lot of people don't exactly like Chadwick Boseman's performance as T'Challa in this film, like they did in Captain America Civil War. Mm-hmm. But me personally, I think that's only because I know for me it works because he's not as damaged as he was since he gave up his path of revenge, since he found out why his father got killed. So it's okay for me personally for him to be a little bit more stoic. And I gotta say that his progression throughout the film makes me really happy. This film as a whole is just great. The only thing I will say about this film that I didn't really like was the final action sequence in the railway station-esque place between Killmonger and T'Challa. I mean, that it kind of looked like a video game from the PlayStation 3. I mean, for me, that's what it looked like. But Michael B. Jordan, absolutely one of the best villains that the Marvel Cinematic Universe has had, and the movie's made a difference. I mean, it's one of those films that you can see. You don't, Matt's right, you don't have to see any of the other Marvel Cinematic Universe films. If you do, though, it does give a little bit of context, but I mean, you don't have to. Like, I mean, there are certain films in the MCU, take the first Iron Man, the first Thor, the first Captain America, you know, all these great solo films. I mean, I would even say Captain America Civil War, you don't necessarily have to have seen all the other MCU films. It does give context. However, very much like Black Panther, you don't need to have seen every other film. It's a great film. It's a brilliant film. It's a film that has a lot to say. And people have their problems with this movie. Me personally, I'm a big messages guy. Me, if a film is great throughout, even though I have some small problems with it, because I do have some problems with Black Panther.
Yeah.
But if the message is there and it's driven home, which it was in Black Panther, that film automatically gets higher up on my rating, and it skyrockets into the top. And Black Panther does that.
Yeah, and when the message is driven home as well as it is in Black Panther, even more so, because there's another film we're going to talk about in the next month's list, so in March, which has messages, but for me they weren't put across very well. This film, though, a plethora of messages, and they all worked. What didn't was some of the CGI was a bit iffy. The final battle, yes, between T'Challa and Killmonger did look, like a cutscene from an old game. But I did like the fact that the final duel itself between the warring tribes was actually kind of hand to hand. And it wasn't as much of a CGI fest. We had the Wakandan warriors. And just to quickly, you don't mess with the women of Wakanda.
No.
They will take you down, brother. I'm not standing up to them. I'm standing aside, man.
Yeah.
All power to them.
You know, and I was going to say, it's incredible. Because this film breaks so much ground. And it's one of the reasons why I'm so glad that Wonder Woman came out last year. It's because Wonder Woman, I believe, was the first film. Like, I don't care what anybody else says, especially you, James Cameron. Wonder Woman was the film that came out last year, and it's for all the movements for women and women's rights and everything that has happened within the film industry, I believe that one of the reasons why it's been so pushed to the forefront that we can have great, strong female characters it is because of what Wonder Woman did. I know Marvel had been doing it for years, but I think Wonder Woman most certainly helped. And if you guys don't know why I said that about James Cameron, because James Cameron's one of the best directors ever. Yes, he is. But James Cameron came out and said that Wonder Woman was not as good of a movie because Wonder Woman is a film that it made women in cinema take a step back. And I'm not going to get into the specifics of really how I feel about that. All I'll say is I was disgusted by that, and Wonder Woman was one of my favorite movies from last year, and the women in Black Panther, yeah, they're amazing.
They are tough. I just imagine that the pressure of writing 6,000 Avatar sequels, which probably may not even see the light of day, probably led James Cameron to have a few drinks that evening and said a few stupid things.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, that's not the first time he said something silly. Another thing which I was only slightly disappointed with about Black Panther was Daniel Kaluuya, I found, was underutilised. His character, and also the way he kind of turned towards the in the middle of the film. But mainly, most of that is actually due to the fact that he was so fantastic in Get Out.
Yeah.
That when I realised he was in this film, I thought, wow, what another name to add to this already insanely talented cast. But I just kind of felt disappointed with his not his performance necessarily, but his character's arc. That was a bit weak for me. But again, there are some fairly well used tropes throughout the film as well. There are moments where you see what that happened, and you'll probably think, well, I know what's going to happen down the line in this film. But that does not take away from the fact that this is a stellar film to come out this year, and it does deserve all of the plaudits that come its way. And anybody who says anything differently because of the cast members or what it stands for, just stop now, because this is a fantastic movie.
I mean, geez, 90% of, I believe that percentage is correct, 90 to 95% of all the cast members were black. It's fantastic. It's a change in the right direction. It's brilliant. And Black Panther is great. And if you guys couldn't already tell, I could not recommend this movie more.
Yep, I'm going to agree with you. And one day, we won't even be talking about the who is in the film or their background. We'll just be talking about how great the film is. And Black Panther certainly starting to lead the way with that, as Wonder Woman did before that as well. So an absolutely big recommendation from myself and Cody as well. There was a film on the list which was missed off the titles. And I'm going to throw it in again. Is I, Tonya. Is a February release. It doesn't seem like it, but it was.
It was. Oh my. I, Tonya. This was another Oscar movie, and Margot Robbie was nominated for Best Actress, and rightfully so. I, Tonya, you know, here's the shameful thing about all this, is that, and I'll be coming out here, is that I didn't see I, Tonya until this year, until 2018, when it came into my area. My buddy Zach Pope, he had been continuously recommending it to me. He's like, it's one of the best movies this year, last year. But I was like, yeah, it hasn't come into my area yet. Sorry. And then it made it into his number four. And I'm going to be perfectly honest, with me personally, with all the films that came out last year, I realize I love The Disaster Artist, but for me personally, I think I, Tonya would have been my number two if I had seen it last year. It would have been Blade Runner and then I, Tonya, which is a weird combination, I know, but the performances, this is something very special for me, because this is the story of Tonya Harding is something that I just was not aware of. And my parents were aware of it. They told me about the awful tragedy of what happened with Nancy Kerrigan, and I really had no idea about it. And then I, Tonya comes out. It completely blows me away. I saw it 3 times in theaters. I absolutely love this movie. I mean, you have Margot Robbie. You have Sebastian Stan. So you have Allison Janney. You have just an all-star cast all around. And the brilliant thing about one of the best things about this movie, besides the performances, is number one, the editing, Number two is the writing. The writing of this movie is so clever. It's so funny. It feels like the Goodfellas of sports movies. I mean, if somebody had told me that Martin Scorsese wrote this script for I, Tonya, I would not be surprised in the least bit. And the dialogue, the way this film was just put together, is so brilliant.
Yeah, Craig Gillespie, the director, this is a black comedy, and there is violence in this film, but it's delivered in a kind of a slapstick way almost. It's very strange to watch it because it's despicable what's happening, but the way it's delivered softens the blow, and the way it's written, like you've mentioned, it's perfect. It's rather than just settling for the drama surrounding the incident, which was, I remember the incident, I was about 9, I think, when it happened. So I do remember it, and obviously subsequently gone back and realised I remembered more than I thought. But this is a black comedy, stuffed full of pathos, emotion, some caper, and some fun. And it depicts Tonya Harding as the person and not the punchline. It doesn't intend to make a fool out of her, to victimize her, to shame her, or even or to glorify her.
Yeah, no,
just her as a person.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing. That's what I explain to everybody that I recommend this movie to, is because I've recommended this movie to people who aren't exactly sure they want to watch it, because they think because it's I, Tonya, it's about Tonya Harding. They instantly, mm-hmm. What's the number one reaction you get? People instantly think that this movie's going to be about the incident and glorifying Tonya Harding. And the movie right off the bat shows you that, no, this is not going to be a movie about glorifying Tonya Harding. In fact, the movie does a pretty great job of just showing you how difficult of a person she was to get along mm-hmm. with, about just how needy and how rednecked and back of the woods she was. I mean, and Margot Robbie. I mean, Margot Robbie was unrecognizable. I remember I went to see this movie the first time with a buddy of mine, and I literally, as soon as we get that picture of Tonya Harding in her 40s or 50s, and it's Margot Robbie, I literally turned to my buddy of mine, and I said, is that Margot Robbie? Because I'm going to tell you right now, it certainly doesn't look like her.
No, and I love Margot Robbie in every way imaginable, and she is absolutely marvellous in this film. She absolutely deserved that nomination at the Academy Awards. It's a transformation. She transforms into Tonya Harding, and I know she worked with Tonya Harding, she met her, and she kind of learned from her somewhat, but this is her spin on it, and it's superb. But let's not forget Alison Janney won the Best Supporting Actress for this film. She is menacingly brilliant in this film. Mm. She is a horrific woman in this film. But when you see Alison Janney in real life, she just looks like the life and soul of the party. In this film, good God, she is horrible. And she is brilliant. And yeah, the cinematography and the camera work is some of the best of the year. Like you mentioned as well, and the writing. It's funny, it's beautiful to look at, it's intriguing. The incident itself was kind of almost sort of pushed to the back end of the film, and almost like a sort of a bino at the end of the film. And as the walls start to close in around the character of Tonya Harding's character, or her, there's like a real sense of kind of tragedy almost, and a quite a surprising sadness. But that comes from the performance and the writing, I think. So this film for me, because it did get a limited release last year in the US. But I think I did do my research because I am clever. The wide release was 2018. So this for me is the film of the year for me so far.
You know what? It's funny you mention that, because generally when I make my list, I don't necessarily films that are limited release in 2017 and then they come into full release 2018. I don't generally count those on my 2018 list. Mm-hmm. It would be my film of the year if it was. But I will say that this is one of the I understand Frances McDormand winning Best Actress at the Oscar last year, because she was absolutely brilliant in Three mm-hmm. Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. However, You know, I think iTonya should have done a double win here. I honestly think that iTonya should have won Best Actress and Best Supporting Actress. It won Best Supporting Actress, which is great. Allison Jenny was magnificent. But Margot Robbie, in my personal opinion, was the best performance of last year, hands down.
Yeah, and we mentioned the Academy Awards earlier on in the post. I was racking my brain thinking there was one film which I would put in. I would take The Post out, and I'm putting iTonya in for Best Picture. Whether or not it wins is a different story, but I think it needed its place in that top tier because it was one of the best films to come out of that time.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, guys. So if you couldn't tell, it's about as high of a recommendation for us as you can get. This film is fantastic. What may change our attitude is the next film we're going to talk about, and that is that's Winchester, the house that was built by the ghost. And
Winchester.
Here's a little thing. You said that you might be getting one rant from me today, and no, you're not. You're getting
Cody's
two.
Crazy Corner.
Yeah, you got that right. It is Cody's Crazy Corner because I already talked about Insidious. I do not despise a movie more from this year than I think as much as I despise Winchester. And the reason is that literally every single – okay, horror movies have come out. I thought we would have learned because the past – from 2012 to now, horror movies, we've had such a good few years with them. I never thought that films in the horror genre would backslide as much as this has. And we have Helen Mirren. We have Jason Clarke. We have two great actors who make up the main performances of this movie. And they're sleepwalking through it. And this movie jump scares literally every single horror movie cliche that you can think of. Oh, you look, there's nothing there. Oh, you turn back around, you go to put something back, you lift your head back up, you turn, oh, there's a scary figure there. I mean, literally, this movie, it makes every single transgression you can make. And okay, here's a plug. If you guys don't know, me and my buddy Zach Pope, we have had many discussions about this. We even created a video on YouTube called The Problem with Modern Horror Movies. And I swear, every single problem that we list in that video, it can be found in this movie. Winchester, it's, and not to mention the fact, it's boring. It's a movie that is long, it's slow, boring, it creates every horror cliche that you can imagine, and it trespasses over every single transgression that you can make in a movie like this. Honestly, this year, right now, there is no movie lower on my least favorite movie of the year list than Winchester. I hated this movie.
Do you know what the most disappointing thing for me is? Up until 2 days ago, I agreed with you, but I have found one more film, which I'm not going to mention until next month, the next episode. There is one film which has now overtaken Winchester for me as the worst of 2018. But that said, Winchester is the second worst film of 2018 it's horrible. What should have been a really tense, atmospheric mystery movie, a ghost story peppered with some really great horror elements, ended up being this horrible, watered down, messy snooze fest, complete with this kid running around with like a Damien Omen haircut, lazily possessed by an unconvincing spirit. And the most frustrating thing for me is there's clearly a good story to be told there. The actual story of the Winchester house and the owner and everything that she's done with it, there is such a good story to take there. But instead, like you've just said, the writers plugged every gap with every cliche known to man. It's lousy dialogue, choppy editing, an awful anti-gun statement to ruin this. Helen Mirren was deemed worthy of a damehood from our beloved Majesty Queen Elizabeth II. And then she's probably going to lose it for being in this film because... I'd be lying if I said I didn't get very, very heavy-lidded during this film. I remember about two-thirds of the way through this film, myself and my exquisite partner, we were both falling, kind of had to sort of like kick each other because we were falling asleep because it was boring. There's nothing grabs you in the film, which is because I really wanted to see Helen Mirren in a horror film because she hadn't done one before. She probably won't ever do one again now, but there's literally, I can't think of anything good to say about this. And I wrote in my review of this film that I can't remember the leading man's name now, which is probably because he's in this film and I'm trying to forget it. Jason Clarke, thank you. He spends the majority of the film just sweating and panicking, and I can only imagine it's because he realises he can't get out of his contract for this film. He has to go through with it. Because it's so bad.
You know what? It is very few times where I will say a film outside of being a horror movie is a horror movie. You know, 50 Shades of Grey, that itself is a horror movie. Yeah. Because it's just so horribly bad. It's a horror movie for just how horrible it is. You know what? It's funny. Because Winchester was made to be a horror film. It's a double entendre now, because it's not only a horrible horror, it's not only a horror movie, it's a horrendously done horror movie. So that makes it horror times two. But you know what? Honestly, Matt, I really want to stop talking about this movie because I have a feeling I'm going to be sick.
I'm going to hasten the guess. This is an educated guess, so stay with me here, that you're not going to recommend this film.
Yeah, you know what? I'm going to recommend to take it out and burn it.
Well, that's two people who are going to recommend that. If you ever see a copy of this, as best as you can, destroy it. Don't pollute the atmosphere, but destroy it as best as you can, please. So moving on from one of the films which was absolutely abysmal to another film which, well, let's just get to it. The Cloverfield Paradox. Fabulously marketed, I'll give them that. J.J. Abrams and Bad Robot, they know how to market a film. Yeah, it's... please lead with this, because this is another film that winds me up.
I'm not going to get as horrible with this, because when it comes to the marketing that J.J. Abrams and his whole team at Bad Robot have done for the Cloverfield movies, I've been appreciative of it, but I can also see how it would backfire. Like, number one, here's the thing, Cloverfield was good. 10 Cloverfield Lane, they didn't release marketing for that movie until 2 months before it was going to come out. They showed one trailer, and I think they showed another one about 3 weeks before the movie was going to be released. I mean, and 10 Cloverfield Lane was one of my favorite movies that year because of just how tense it was and the atmosphere that they built. With the Cloverfield Paradox, we literally, and you know, originally it was going to be God Particle.
Yeah.
And apparently God Particle is, we've got another Cloverfield movie happening. Apparently Cloverfield Paradox is his own thing. But, you know, a Cloverfield Paradox, it literally, all of the marketing happened while we were watching the Super Bowl. And it was like, Oh, after the Super Bowl, turn on Netflix and watch it. And you know what? That is a good marketing strategy.
It's fantastic.
But now I think I understand why they did it. Because Cloverfield Paradox, it was not good. It just was not good. And it's a shame. Look, I mean, with all the actors in the movie were great. And I thought there was some level of mystery to it. But other than that, the movie was slow. The script was horrendous. A lot of the same issues that we've had with a lot of the other movies we've talked about so far. This movie trespasses on those big time. The only things that really make this movie bearable is the performances and a little bit of mystery. Honestly, to be perfectly frank, this movie had 15 minutes left to go, and I just decided to turn my computer off and go to bed.
And the sleep was probably a heck of a lot more entertaining. Laying there prone to the world, gone to the world, was probably a lot more entertaining. The God Particle was a film, that particular film, and I've said this about a few films on this episode, and I'm pretty sure in future episodes I'm going to say the same. I thought it was a brilliant story. In an attempt to save the planet, a group of scientists lose the Earth. Essentially, the Earth disappears because of something that they have done. Awesome. That to me, it sounds great. And for the first, certainly first third of the movie, maybe even the first half, there is a wonderful intrigue and mystery which is built up, as you don't know what on earth is going on, and it seems like the characters are in the same boat. Nobody knows what's going on, and it kind of got really started to get me thinking that, hold on, this could be excellent. But then, unfortunately, the movie very quickly stops playing to its strengths, and it kind of stumbles and gropes through a really flaccid, generic sci-fi second half. Everything that's built up in that first idea, and there are some cool ideas in the first half of the film, it was just blown away in the second half of the film when the typical space peril conventions come flooding out, and the end scene, the very, very end scene, which you probably missed actually if you were asleep, it just made me want to put my head through the window, because they tried so hard to tie this into Cloverfield, where, you know, on the side of the ship it may have said in very small letters, you know, the Cloverfield or whatever the ship was called. But other than that, there was literally no tie-in to the Cloverfield universe. And I know that the three films are very loosely connected within the same universe, but you could tell this was literally somebody else's story, which they've just slapped a sticker on with Cloverfield. And that end sequence scene to try and link it all together was one of the worst end scenes I've seen in an awfully long time.
Yeah. I hate this movie.
2 out of 2.
Yeah. 2 out of 2. We both hate this movie.
Yeah. It's I wanted to like it.
What I'll say is I'm interested to see what J.J. Abrams and his team do with the Cloverfield stuff down the road. Because I know they still have plans to continue on with a sequel to 10 Cloverfield Lane. And I am interested to see that. But I just hope they get their stuff together, because this was a poor excuse for an attempt.
Yeah, and I've heard that they're wanting to do an actual direct sequel to the original Cloverfield, which could be quite interesting. But I just wonder how much they're going to tie together, all of these films they've created. Because at the minute, there is a very, very, very loose narrative. Cloverfield and 10 Cloverfield Lane share more in common than this film does to those two. And yeah, the marketing gimmick was fantastic, but if you kind of very quickly peel the layers away, it's probably because the studio had absolutely no faith that this film was going to make any money at the box office or get any kind of acclaim. So basically, throw it on Netflix and people will forget about it very quickly.
Yeah,
which I already have done. It's only by doing this show have I actually bothered to think about it since I've seen it.
You know, it's actually funny because, you know what? I don't recommend this movie.
I didn't think you were going to say that. No, I'm on the same boat. I really did want to like this film because Cloverfield is a franchise, that word, the F word, franchise, which I dearly want to like. I really would like it to succeed for some reason. I don't know why, but I really like to see it work because it's kind of a sort of a kooky franchise, which I've mentioned doesn't really fit together, but kind of does. And I'd like to see a truly great movie come from these guys, but it wasn't this film, and I would not recommend this to anybody unless you're an absolute bastard of a friend and want to make somebody sit through it. But I'm also interested in what you think about the next film.
Well, you know what's funny? You aren't going to get my opinion about the next film, because although I do love Duncan Jones, I have not seen Mute.
I will quickly interject then to say... Good, because this is the 3 out of 3 for me. We started off February, you know, 50 Shades Freed, we ignore that. We had The Excellence of Black Panther, the majestic I, Tonya. Then we've slid into the dumpster fires of Winchester and the Cloverfield Paradox. And now we're ending it with Mute, which is, yeah, Duncan Jones' baby, 10 years in the making. And it's clearly sort of Blade Runner light. So I think you'll dig the visuals. What you'll think about the film, obviously, who knows until you see it. But for me, it aimed for that high-class neo-futuristic noir film. But unfortunately, it ended up being a slow-paced, overly long and slightly boring neo-futurist noir. And that's even when it wants to be, because tonally it switches back and forward as if you had two different directors working on this film. Because one part of it is a brooding investigation kind of hunt with the mute lead character, who, as you go on, I question whether he actually needed to be mute at all. It doesn't really play into the story at all. But the other part is a literally an oddball kind of buddy comedy film between Paul Rudd and his co-star. It's there's no identity to this film. It looks great sometimes. The Berlin streets are given some great attention. They look grimy, dystopian. They look old. They look ugly. But at the same time, also managed to look a bit cheap. So I don't know if that's because that's how Netflix have just wanted it to look, but it looked great and at the same time looked cheap. So what I'm basically trying to say is this movie is a bit of a mess. And that phrase again, there is a good story somewhere, but it just wasn't executed very well, which is a shame because this is the same guy who gave us Moon, which was a fantastic film. But this is just bland. It's not a terrible movie, by any means. There are two worse movies this month that came out, that month. It's just black. It's an ambitious movie that just doesn't hit the target, unfortunately. And in terms of Netflix, with things like Bright and the Cloverfield Paradox and now this, that's a couple of big misses they've had. So I'd be interested to see what you think about the film, because it does play very much into that kind of Blade Runner feel. It just doesn't hit the heights of Blade Runner.
Well, within the next few months, I will see what I can do.
Excellent. I mean, like I say, it's not a terrible movie. I didn't hate the film, but it just, you could see what it was reaching for. It just didn't achieve it. It was out of grasp, I think, but which is a shame because Duncan Jones is extremely passionate. You only have to see on social media when the film came out how proud he was of this film. And he kind of almost made you feel bad when I was writing a review thinking, I didn't actually like this very much. And a lot of the internet and the film critics out there seem to be on the same page. But it's not the worst. It won't be the worst film we see this year, but it does fall into the category for me of just very forgettable. You watch it and then it's very bland. There's not much to take from it other than Netflix really needs to start making some good films.
Yeah. You know what? I think that's a good segue. Speaking of good films, I think we're about to move into a month that's had the best films of the ones we're going to be talking about.
Absolutely.
So you know what, guys? It's time. It's time for us to move right on in to the month of March. And the movies within the month of March are Red Sparrow, Game Night, A Wrinkle in Time, Tomb Raider, Pacific Rim Uprising, or Pacific Rim 2, Ready Player One, Isle of Dogs, Annihilation, Blockers, Veronica, and Love, Simon. And we start out with Red Sparrow. Now, I know earlier I said that there was a film that I feel was a better interpretation of 50 Shades of Grey. Red Sparrow is that movie. Now, is it a movie for everybody? Absolutely not. It is very adult. It is very rated R. The movie is very, very sexually strong. But it's one of those movies, there's a lot of sex and nudity in the movie. But I always came across and said that the sex and nudity, it has a place in my opinion. This is one of the films where all the content, it's very, very strong, very hard material to watch. It's very brutal. But it's one of those films where I actually really, I can't say I enjoyed it. I said, when I got out of the movie theater, I thought it was a very, very well done film. And I thought the message in it was powerful. Now, here's the thing. This is a story about a woman who's had to deal with very, very abusive, awful relationships with controlling men for her entire life. And then she finds an American who, while working for her Russian government, she finds an American who she falls in love with and creates a loving and pure relationship. Although it's probably not a wholesome relationship because he's got his own problems too. But when it comes to the 50 Shades of Grey movies, this is the kind of film that I wanted from them. If we could get a interpretation of 50 Shades of Grey where Anastasia Steele, she started out in a very, very abusive relationship with a character like Mr. Grey, and then she found someone in a relationship that was who was just as messed up as she was, that's something that I would have enjoyed a lot more. But Red Sparrow, I will say once again, All the performances are great. The material is very, very hard to watch. I can't emphasize that enough. And this is a film, I saw it twice when it was in theaters because I wanted to get as much from it as I could. But this is a movie I don't think I could watch again, but I do think it is important to see.
Yeah, there are some films which are undoubtedly very good, but they don't warrant repeat viewings. Not because they're bad films, but because, like you say, they can be very heavy. Red Sparrow, it absolutely smoulders with the pacing of a snail, but in this instance, it's all the better for it. Similar to Hazard of Molly's Game. This is a long film. It's about 2 hours, 20 minutes long, but every part of it feels vital. It doesn't feel long. To me, it didn't anyway. The slow burn nature works because every scene seems vital to the plot. Francis Lawrence, no relation to Jennifer, but he crafts every scene intricately enough to be interesting. In terms of the actual story, it did start to feel a bit heavy and on the verge of becoming convoluted at times, but it remained more than intriguing enough to be interesting. And Lawrence and Edgerton are high class. It's become almost, you know, standard now to say that those two give top performances. But it's not just a case of using sex as a weapon, even though it mainly is. But it's also a strong story of a woman deciphering the needs and the weaknesses of these powerful men and just systematically taking them down. So it's certainly more than meets the eye. And it's unashamedly open with its violence, its gore, sex, nudity. It's not for the faint-hearted at all. There's exposed bones, skin grafts, corpses. There's naked bits everywhere. It's raw, it's brutal, but it's compelling. You've said it, you've nailed it. It's not for everybody. There will be people who just won't attach themselves to the film. That's just how it is sometimes. But if you can sit down and watch it, and I use the phrase get through it in the most positive way, if you can get through it, you will be rewarded because it's an absolute treat of a film. It is slow. It is, you know, at times a tough watch, but underneath it all, there's still a fantastic story, anchored by fantastic, fantastic lead performances, and very well written as well. So I've got high praise for this film.
Yeah, so do I. And just to emphasize the point of how hard this was of a watch, let me tell you, when I went to see Red Sparrow, the theater was semi-full. It was about half full. About an hour into the movie, because of the content and the subject material, there were a couple of people who just got up and left and didn't stick around. Wow. Because they felt uncomfortable. But yeah, I mean, if you're the kind of person who this kind of subject matter doesn't bother you, then I think that you will get something from it. Because this film isn't just a film that makes you look at how other countries may or may not have run their governments and what they've done to get information. But it is, at its core, it is a story about love, about relationships, about getting yourself out of an undesirable circumstance, which, like I said, in my opinion, that's what the 50 Shades of Grey film should have been. I don't care if the original creator wouldn't have been happy with it. The 50 Shades of Grey films, I think, should have been a story of – it could have been a story of escape. It would have been uncomfortable to watch for sure. But if we had a story of Anastasia Steele, this woman – who is a victim of sexual violence, making her way over the course of these three films, getting away from this person and eventually either locking him up or killing him, I think the 50 Shades of Grey movies would have been 10 times better. But honestly, depending on who you are, because I can't recommend this to everybody, but like I said, depending on who you are, if you can handle this kind of subject matter and the subject matter that's in the film, it is a recommendation for me.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to recommend it with that asterisk, that caveat, that don't come at me if you didn't like it, because it won't be for everybody. But in terms of the film as a standalone film, would I recommend people go to see it? Absolutely, I would. What you take from it yourselves is obviously, that's the beauty of film. It's subjective. What you see may be completely different to what Cody and myself see. But, you know, I'd absolutely recommend this for the performances, for the story, for the filmmaking, for every aspect of it. I highly recommend this film. So Red Sparrow gets two thumbs up from us. And from the brutally heavy to the completely other side now.
So awesome.
Game Night.
Yes.
Absolutely. Game Night, which is, for me, was successful in its only aim. It needed to be funny. And for me, it was funny. There's a brilliant chemistry between the entirety of the cast, not just Jason Bateman and Rachel McAdams. The entire cast is brilliant. They all get their time to shine and add to the story, which is quite nice. They're not, you don't just have two people and then the rest are relegated to the background. And the main story, for the most part, is executed pretty well. By the time we got to the end, it did get a bit over the top and sort of deviate slightly too much from the path. But it's a short runtime, so there's no need for the film to drag. And it absolutely thunders through its 100-minute duration at the expense of good editing at times. Sometimes the editing is clunky. It's not a perfect film, but it's definitely a fun way to spend an evening. And Bateman's McAdams and Jesse Plemons was a fantastic to watch. So if you want a fun movie to sit in, have a laugh with, again, get the pizza in, get your friends around, just have a good time, have your own game night, put Game Night on. It's not perfect, but it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, you know what? I didn't see this. I'm just kidding. I absolutely loved, let me repeat that, loved Game Night. Game Night, I mean, this was the start for me personally this year. I think we are seeing comedies going back on the uprise. And I think Game Night is one of the reasons. Game Night, it's one of my favorite films of the year simply because of what the film sets out to do. It's set out to be entertaining. It's set out to be a comedy. And the movie, one of my favorite things, I think a good comedy, it's not just vulgar toilet humor, but it goes to really high sophisticated humor that makes you think for a little bit and then makes you laugh. Or, you know, makes you wait a little bit and then reveals what you're going to be laughing at. And that's, I mean, performances around, everybody has great chemistry. You're right, they do. And it was... You know, it's such an experience. Let me tell you, my parents, they are very, very particular when it comes to the comedies that they watch. They're very particular. And I told them, trust me, you go see Game Night. Come see Game Night with me. You are not going to regret it. And they didn't. My mother came so far as to say that it's one of the funniest movies that she's in a while. That scene where Rachel McAdams is trying to sew up the bullet wound for Jason Bateman.
That is
possibly the funniest scene in a movie I have seen all year. This film... And you know what? A good comedy. The main thing about a good comedy, it comes with actors who can not only improvise, but it comes with really, really smart and clever writing. And yeah, the last act, it did get a little clunky, and the editing, it went here and there after a while. But Game Night, it was such a pleasure to watch. And I mean, it's great to see a contrast from Red Sparrow, which I believe came out the week before.
Yeah,
you had the heavy subject matter, which was Red Sparrow. Then the following week, you have this really, really light-hearted comedy, which, in my opinion, you ask me, yeah, I don't know who the people are who are going to take their kids to rated R movies, but don't do that. But I will say, I mean, for anyone, I mean, a teenager who's like 15 years old, I could say. So, I mean... I don't say this very much when it comes to movies that are rated R, but if your kids are old enough, I honestly think that this is literally a movie for everybody. This is a comedy for everybody because it just hits every note perfectly. And one of my favorite things is the movie had a surprising amount of heart to it. And I came out of the movie and I said, you know what? I'm going to contact my friends. And, you know, I want to do this. I want to start a game night. I want to do what they do. Maybe not exactly what they do, but I want to start a game night. And you know what? This movie is so good.
It's a good fun film. It's got those great messages of friendship and also parenting as well. There's some great parenting messages in there, sort of scattered and littered throughout. Jesse Plemons is superb as the neighbour, the cop, who's just, he's hilarious. And the scene where Jason Bateman is trying to extract information from his computer whilst the rest distract him, and the little white Westie dog walks in, and you've seen it in the trailers, he gets covered in the red wine. That scene for me was fantastic. Just watching Jason Bateman try to scrub this dog was superb. Just thinking about it, a certain part of it made me smile because it is one of those good time films where I agree, it's not It's not overly raunchy. I don't believe that it will offend anyone who's, yeah, like say 15 or above. There's nothing in it which is too crazy. You know, there are scenes in there with guns and things like that, which, you know, younger people may not want to be exposed to.
You know, this is the way I see it. I mean, by the time you're 15, 16 years old, at least this was my experience in high school, is the fact that by the time I was 15, 16 years old, and I've had conversations with my mom about this because she said it was the exact same thing for her. I'm pretty sure that I had maybe not seen everything, but I'm pretty sure that I had literally heard every curse word and every offensive thing that was in the book. But of course, it does come down to what the kids are able to handle, what the parents are able to handle. So once again, for me personally, I mean, this is just for me, but depending on who you are, I do think this is a comedy for families, once the kids are old enough and you think they can handle this sort of material, which I don't think it's too bad. I mean, I don't necessarily think it's too overly raunchy. I think some of the humor was raunchy, yeah. But you're going to find that in all comedies. All good comedies have at least a little bit of raunch inside them. I mean, you even look at a PG-13 romantic comedy Crazy Stupid Love. I absolutely love that movie, yeah. But it's for the same exact reason. It does have a little bit of raunch related comedy, but it goes into all aspects of comedy, not just raunch, but also relationships to do, also humor to deal with relationships. So if you and your family want to watch a really good and entertaining movie and your kids can watch rated R movies, then yeah, the high recommendation.
Yeah, there's R-rated comedies coming out this year, which are going to be a lot worse than this film in terms of the content. But I agree, it's all about the exposure you want for your own family, and that's obviously individual. For the film, for me, and for Cody for sure, it's a recommendation. I enjoyed this. I had fun with it. Even when I've mentioned it, for me, it started to derail a bit towards the end. But I still found myself enjoying it, and by the end of it, I felt good by the time the end credits rolled. And if a comedy can make me laugh and also at the same time make me feel pretty good, it's a double thumbs up from me. So Game Night, you got two recommendations.
Oh boy, here we go again. You know what?
So it begins.
Yeah, so it begins. You know what? This next film. I'm not going to rant about this one. I'm just going to say it's tragic. And it's Ava DuVernay's A Wrinkle in Time. This film, look, guys, I'm just going to say up front, I don't recommend this movie. And the number one reason is because although this film is filled with pretty solid performances and decent visuals, all the footage that you see from the trailers, those scenes, yeah, the visuals are great. But the film as a whole, it was convoluted, it was slow, it was boring. I forgot most of what happened in the movie, and at a certain point, I did feel that the movie was a little bit preachy. So, honestly, this is a movie I don't necessarily want to take the longest time talking about it, because this movie, it kind of depressed me in a way, because Ava DuVernay is one of the best directors working today. And mm-hmm. I loved all of her previous work, but this was this was a tough beat. And this was just a downright shame that it just failed so spectacularly.
Yeah, I loved this film.
What?
I'm kidding. I'm not a good liar. I did not. I'm on the same boat. This was an ambitious movie. Apparently, it was unfilmable, it was called. I think there was an earlier TV movie a decade or so ago. Ambition should always be applauded, but that doesn't always mean it's going to be successful, and that is the case here. Visually, in terms of colour and verve, the film looks great until you get moments such as Reese Witherspoon turning into a lettuce leaf. Which just, I thought, what on earth is going on? And from then on, there's a lot of dodgy CGI and certain things which, given the power behind this film with Disney and their cumulative power resource, are slightly disappointed with how the film looked. And everybody does give their all. The youngsters actually are the best part of the film. The younger members of the cast steal the show. But yeah. I just felt a strange kind of disconnect with the movie. there's a lot of moments which are sort of aimed to be emotional, which don't work. One of them did. One of them I did enjoy towards the end of the film. But for the most part, it just didn't feel satisfying. The plot was very sticky. There was the plot. There's a whole episode we could talk about the plot, because the way the plot unfolds in the narrative is bloody awful. But, and there are some great messages, you know, empowerment, diversity. But like you said, towards the end, it feels like messages for messages' sake. It felt like the need to get these statements out of there actually overtook the need for story in a good film. It just felt a bit generic for me, when it really should have been. It should have been out of this world, but it just felt hollow and a bit mawkish. And yeah, the story didn't click for me. So the fantastical fantasy fell a bit short, really. This was a big disappointment.
It's a shame. It really is a shame. And like we've been saying, Ava DuVernay, she's a fantastic director. She's done marvelous work. We've seen it. We've seen the brilliance that comes with her direction. But this was a rough patch. I mean, it's going to happen to everybody. It's going to happen to every director out there. But
she'll come back with another great film next, I'm sure.
I mean, she will. I mean, she's got to take the criticism, or she doesn't have to. But she's the kind of person I think that will. But yeah. Once again, like I said at the beginning of this, I don't recommend this.
No, this is the first time in the March titles where we're both going to give a thumbs down. Steer clear of this. Honestly, there's not much. It's sad to say, because I wanted to like this, but yeah, just don't bother. Whereas the next film did kind of surprise me a bit. The next film is Tomb Raider, the new iteration after the Angelina Jolie-led films of the early 2000s. This one is desperately tries to be taken seriously, because it takes itself very seriously. It's gritty. It's a lot more realistic, if you will, until it starts talking about ancient Japanese ghosts and curses. Then it all gets a bit silly. But Alicia Vikander, who is an Academy Award winning actress, and usually in all of the films she's in, even the Field Nappy that was Tulip Fever, she was very good in that. But she's fantastic. She anchors this film with an absolutely tireless performance. And in terms of the story, there's nothing you won't see coming from a mile off, because it's so badly telegraphed, or it's been explained in the... This film probably got some of the worst dialogue of this year. But there's enough here for me that created a really entertaining adventure flick. It's one of the better video game adaptations out there. And even though that genre is a cesspit, it may not be saying much, I had quite a good time with Tomb Raider. It wasn't in any way a perfect film, or in fact a very good film, but I enjoyed it. I thought it was a pretty serviceable movie.
Yeah, so did I. I really, really enjoyed Tomb Raider. And people have their differing opinions about this. And me personally, I do think that out of all the video game-based movies that we've gotten, I do think Tomb Raider is the best. That's just my personal opinion, but... Honestly, I'd say the first two acts, and even a little bit into the third act, I thought it was going really well. I was seeing exactly what I wanted. And here's the thing. When it comes to Uncharted, Nathan Drake, or Lara Croft with Tomb Raider, one of the things you need to focus on are those crazy, bonkers, out-of-this-world action sequences where, where either Nathan Drake or Lara Croft are hanging from a cliff, and you know something is just going to go bad. And it does, and when it's on screen with Lara Croft, it is amazing and fantastic. And one of the things I always appreciate when actors did this, but when Alicia Vikander did this, I thought it was amazing, because from everything that she's done up to Tomb Raider, she's always been a very, very skinny girl. I mean, she herself has said this, that she's always been a very thin girl. She put on 12 pounds of muscle to play Lara Croft, and yeah, it definitely shows.
She trained hard.
Yeah, she definitely trained hard. I mean, she got muscular, she got ripped. I mean, you could see every muscle in her body ripple whenever she moves. It's fantastic that she got into that kind of shape. And that shows, I mean, whenever actors do this, it shows the level of dedication and passion for the work that they're doing. I mean, you see it when it comes to Chris Evans as Captain America, or Hugh Jackman as Logan or Wolverine. You see it when actors do this, it's just great. And the whole idea of Tomb Raider, yeah, the ending, most of the third act was absolutely ridiculous, which I know when it comes to both Tomb Raider and when it comes to Uncharted, there is a level of the supernatural that are in the video games. But that works with the video games. Honestly, when it comes to Lara Croft, I feel if they wanted to introduce more supernatural stuff, I think they should have waited for another movie or two. And this is one of those things where I want Tomb Raider to get a sequel because I want to see Alicia Vikander get another chance to play Lara Croft. Because it's obvious that she had a lot of passion for this. And from what people are saying, people had a lot of fun watching this movie. And I have to agree, I had a lot of fun. And I think this movie definitely puts a lot of steps in the right direction when it comes to the video game genre.
Yeah, absolutely. The box office for this film was, you know, kind of average. So I think it's fairly touch and go whether it's going to get a sequel. I'd say there was enough interest in the film to warrant at least a sequel, I'd say. And I'd like to see Alicia Vikander in the role again, because like you say, the amount of work she put in clearly proves that she thought this was a film, or the F word, franchise, worth investing in. I'd like to see where they take it next. Whether or not they'll get that chance is another story, and we'll have to wait and see. But I had a good time with this film. I went into it with fairly low expectations, and that just comes with the fact that it's a video game adaptation, which are notoriously not great. But those expectations were subverted. I had a great time. I can't remember what I gave in my review, but it was a positive review. I think it's about 7, 7.5 out of 10. So, you know, it's not gonna attack my top 10 or 20 of the year probably, but it's certainly not gonna be anywhere near the worst. I had a good time with this film, and anybody out listening who hasn't seen Tomb Raider, check it out. You may surprise yourself and enjoy it, because I did.
Yeah, it's a bit of fun. It's pretty fun. I mean, it's kind of like The Commuter, although I'm gonna put this out there. I do think that Tomb Raider is much better than The Commuter.
Yes.
But so if you are an adventure and action junkie and you've got nothing to do, say on a Saturday evening, rent the movie out. I mean, Matt's right. You may surprise yourself with how much you enjoy it.
Check it out. Vikander's fantastic. There is some good humor in the film. I was surprised by that. And if you can navigate past the supernatural bits, which do kind of take away from the realism that they went for, I think you'll have a great time. So, speaking of great times, or you may or may not have a great time,
oh boy.
What is next?
Oh, jeez. Okay. So, next up is Pacific Rim 2, a sequel to Pacific Rim, which the first Pacific Rim movie was a movie I very much enjoyed. Didn't think it was all that special. I did enjoy it, though.
Yes.
Pacific Rim 2, I hated this movie. Yeah. No, here Pacific Rim 2... I'm not going to rant. Like, Pacific Rim 2, I could easily rant about this movie, but it suffers from sequel-itis. I mean, this isn't like a series that started horribly, like the 50 Shades series. This isn't a movie that was its own singular thing that was horrible at the very beginning, like Winchester. No. I mean, Pacific Rim 2... I wasn't surprised that it was bad, because when it comes to sequels for popular movies, I always go in kind of skeptical. I mean, you guys, for those of you listening, I'm a giant Star Wars fan. And even when I go to see films like The Last Jedi, or, you know, I'm going to see Solo, this is – I always go into it with a grain of salt. I always take back and say, you know, sequels, they can either be really good or they can be terrible. Unfortunately, Pacific Rim was just terrible. For me, it was just – I enjoy the cartoonish nature of the first Pacific Rim because I believe it worked for that movie. But the cartoonish nature that is in this movie, there's something that happens with Charlie Day's character.
Oh, geez.
For those of you – honestly, the movie might be worth renting just for that little segment, but I'm just going to say this. Jar Jar Binks level bad. It's horrendous. And I mean, the action scenes were super dumb. They were super boring. This film as a whole was just kind of a pathetic excuse for a sequel for me. I mean, even John Boyega, I thought he was okay in this movie, but another part of me says, you know, I feel like anybody else could have filled his role.
That's interesting, because I thought he brought a certain charisma, which I think there could have been certain other actors who could have done well, but I think his performance saved the movie from really sinking into the breach. But I went into this film having to remind myself that this movie contains mind-twinning robots fighting aliens that appear from another dimension. So I kind of went in thinking, right, don't expect too much from this. So with that out of the way, it's quite fair to say Pac Rim 2 doesn't require any brain activity, and that's not always a bad thing. There are people out there who adore these films, and that's just fine. There's nothing wrong with that whatsoever. But it's a fact. I found it to be quite entertaining.
Okay.
But not in a way that is enjoyable, if that makes any sense. The negatives weigh it down far too much. The original, with Del Toro's original, kind of created a mystique to the characters, and even the kaiju and the robots, they had this kind of aura about them, whereas in this film, they're just there to smash things up and bash things. It's spectacle over substance here, which is a shame. Charlie Day, I hope I never see him on screen ever again after this film, because that eye-rollingly tedious twist halfway through with a whiny explanation to hammer home just how bad it was, it absolutely just ruined it. And he was, like you say, the Jar Jar is so bad. I don't know what film he thought he was in, but even though this film is a kind of, you know, daft action film, he kind of took it to another level just by his performance. It's a big movie, it's brash, it's loud, it's cheesy, it's dumb, it's probably better than most of the Transformers films, I'm all just put that in.
Yeah, you know what's funny? Considering it's a big, dumb action film and we're talking about Jar Jar, Charlie Day probably thought he was auditioning for Star Wars.
he could have done that role. He was absolutely horrible in this film. And I don't mean that in terms of his character. His performance was absolutely just off the chart.
You know what?
Terrible.
I find it funny because you can put a comparison to the first Transformers movie to the rest of the Transformers movies with the Pacific Rim films, in my opinion. Yeah. I mean, I know there are people who don't like all of the Transformers movies. Me, I mean, the first Transformers movies is still one of my favorite summer movies to watch every single summer, because I think it's not only a film that's really fun, but it does set about the lore of the Transformers, I feel, correctly. And it's a movie that's got a lot of heart. I think Shia LaBeouf gave a really good performance in that film. And, you know, same thing with Pacific Rim, although Shia LaBeouf was not in Pacific Rim, but we got set up with these Jaegers, with these giant robots. We got set up with the kaiju. We got some mystique. We got some mystery. We understand where all these – we set up the lore of the world that we were in. Guillermo del Toro certainly set that up beautifully, although I think he does better when he goes back to his little indie films like Shape of Water, which was fantastic. But, you know, and then very much like with Transformers – Pacific Rim 2 becomes very, very overly bloated, and everything is simply there because they want it. It's boring, it's long, it's tedious, and they're just there for action scenes. And you know what's funny? Pacific Rim 2 Uprising is one of my least films of this year. One of my least favorite films of last year was Transformers The Last Knight, because Transformers The Last Knight was bloated. It was only there because they wanted to blow stuff up. There was no plot whatsoever. And both of these films were a complete mess.
I hated Transformers The Last Knight with an unbridled fury. It's part of it stems from the fact that I did enjoy that first Transformers. And I've mentioned before that as a kid, I used to love Transformers. I remember the old cartoon film. I used to have all the toys. Optimus Prime was my hero. I used to love it. And then obviously seeing how those films have evolved from that quite decent first one, and obviously just the general history of the Transformers to where it ended up, was just abysmal. And it's shamefully, because they make so much money, it was inevitable that we were going to keep getting more. But Michael Bay, hang your head in shame, or just get out of Hollywood, because you've ruined that franchise almost. But funny, the thing about Pacific Rim Uprising was whilst I enjoyed it on a kind of mindless, hey, look, there's robots beating up and aliens from another dimension level, which is a strange phrase. So I did enjoy that level. This is the first movie I've seen in a long time where the audience that I was with positively cheered as the movie finished. And I don't mean that because it had finished, but the people in the crowd, they were cheering and clapping. And that doesn't, I've mentioned before, we're English. We don't know how to emote apart from to tut and nod. to have a screen actually sit there and, you know, cheer and say how much of a good time I had. I haven't seen that in an awful long time. And there's another film which we're going to talk about in the next episode, which had the screen hollering and whooping and crying.
Yeah, I know which one you're talking about.
You think you do, but for this film, I couldn't believe it because I kind of watched it and thought, right, okay, I enjoyed some parts of that, but I'm glad it's over now. The majority of the audience loved it, so I found that as a surprise. But if you're going to ask me to recommend it, I'm going to say no, I don't.
Yeah, no, I am not surprised that you said that because I don't recommend it either.
Again, not surprised in the slightest. The next one, though, I'm interested in your thoughts for the next film, Ready Player One.
Oh, yes. We come back home. You know what? This is not a biographical picture. It is directed by Steven Spielberg.
It's a blockbuster.
And you know what? Here's the funny thing. The score isn't done by John Williams. It's done by the guy who brought us the score for Back to the Future. And it's, I think, Alan Silvestri, I believe that's the composer's name.
Yep.
Ready Player One, I absolutely love this movie. And there's a very specific reason why. It's because with this film, it made me think like we were going back to Spielberg's roots. It made me feel like we were going back to Jaws, like we were going back to Jurassic Park, like we were going back to E.T. All these films that Spielberg has done that just filled the theater up with people and made us feel his Spielberg magic, that childlike magic. Although this is a film made definitely for this generation, for the kids of this generation, I could not love this movie more. I mean, it's one of my favorite films of this year. I've seen it twice now in theaters, and both times I got more out of it. And honestly, I kind of want to go see it again. And Steven Spielberg, he's done what he always does. Plus all the cast was great. Ben Mendelsohn once again made a great villain. This film as a whole, I can't really say any more than from top to bottom, I loved this movie.
I liked this movie.
What?
Is what I'll say. I did. I didn't dislike it. I went in, I've said it five times, I went in really wanting to be blown away, but I came out disliking the film. I didn't dislike it, but what I did like was everywhere you look on screen, there's these pop culture references galore. It's bursting at the seams of them. And these moments are what the movie was pretty heavily marketed on. It's kind of nostalgia factor. And for me, part of that is because behind all of that, to me, the story wasn't fantastic.
What?
The actual narrative of the film, to me, wasn't particularly strong. It wasn't bad. I could never say this film was a bad film because it wasn't. It's got some of my favourite moments of the year in. But it just didn't grab me and demand my attention. And maybe part of that was also because I was so busy looking for the Easter eggs which are scattered in every scene as well. But the characters, though, they're well acted. Ty Sheridan surprised me in being very good as the lead. Olivia Cooke, I love Olivia Cooke. I thought she was great. You can say that some of the characterisations are a bit thin. Ben Mendelsohn was a great villain. Ben Mendelsohn is just a villain. He's a fantastic actor and he just works as a villain. I don't want to say what my favourite part of the film is because I know I'm not usually too bothered about giving spoilers out for a film that's been out for so long and is so popular. But there's one particular set piece in the middle of the film which is taken from a film we've already mentioned, a horror film we've already mentioned way back in the start of the show. But there's one set piece which absolutely had me on the edge of my seat. It was fantastic. The way they spliced in the existing footage, historical footage, with the new footage was just seamless.
Yep.
And it was brilliant, that particular scene. But another thing which I was just frustrated about was there's no real message, and there was, which kind of felt like a missed opportunity.
No real message?
Well, what I mean was I don't think that they went as far into the digital age and the world that we lived in as much as they could have done. I think they went too much for the wow factor. At the end, there's the message, absolutely, but I thought it was kind of glossed over a bit, for me, a bit too much. What could have been an absolute blast of awesomeness just ended up being very good, as opposed to the awesomeness I wanted.
Well, but, you know,
so if it sounds like I'm being negative, I certainly don't mean to, because I did enjoy this film.
You know, the film for me, honestly, I think the message, you know, they did say what the message was at the end of the film, but I thought the film was there from the very beginning, that the fact that people are spending so much time in a digital world that it caused somebody who had an appreciation for all the meta stuff that we have when it comes to films and television shows and video games to create this oasis, this paradise where people can become the best versions of themselves that they want to be. But that doesn't mean that you should be spending all of your time inside of a digital world, which, I mean, that's the message that was there in the film, and that's the message that I felt that Steven Spielberg brilliantly put in there from the beginning to end. And Ready Player One is one of those films where, you know, I'm a giant nerd, always have been, always will be, and all the references and stuff that they had in the movie from beginning to end, those are the stuff that, besides, you know, the performances and what Spielberg did with all of it, it's some of the stuff that I loved, and it's a film that I can't wait to watch it again, because I have not nearly begun to get all the references that were in that movie.
There, it is packed with them. And one of the things I thought when I was watching it was, I got the references, clearly you did, but, you know, I'm thinking about kids who are kind of, I don't know, up to the age of maybe 14, 15. Do you think they're going to understand some of these references? Because some of them are quite deep cuts from the 80s and the 90s, and even some of the ones are more popular ones. I did wonder whether or not that kind of younger generation who the film is kind of also aimed at, I wonder what they took from it, if they took how they came out feeling. Because obviously I enjoyed it, and I loved the references. I just wonder what the younger generation took from it. That's what I took when I came out.
I mean, I'm not sure. I think parents can use this movie as a teaching tool, because, you know, in today's day and age, you know, in the society that we live in, everybody's on their cell phones, everybody's on a laptop. I mean, yeah. Recording this podcast, we're using hardware and stuff like this all the time. But then you see kids every day, and it's like they're just so absorbed into their electronic devices that they're not actually getting a chance to see the real world. And so I definitely think that even if kids don't necessarily get the references and that stuff, I think parents can use this film as a teaching tool to help their kids get more active, get outside. Because here's the thing. The electronic world, all that stuff will always be there. You can't live your life inside of a screen.
It's appealing sometimes, isn't it, when you see what's going on in the real world? But yeah, that's a good point. It's a good point. I the nostalgia factor hit me right where it needed to. But just for me, that once I looked past that, the story itself, the actual plot, the main plot, it didn't grab me like I wanted to, which doesn't mean that I'm going to say it's a bad film, because it would be foolish to say that. And there are people out there who don't like it. Again, entirely understandable, but for me, I think the main reason was because I went in wanting to love it. It's a Spielberg, that kind of film of old, which he's so good at doing. And I think it might have just been my own expectations which knocked me down a few levels, but I still thought the movie is very good. And am I going to recommend it? I'm absolutely going to recommend it.
Yep, and you guys heard it here first. Matt recommends it, and I do also recommend it.
I thought you were going to, but I'm glad you didn't throw a curveball then and say not going to. This next film, I'm interested in what you think about it. The next film is Isle of Dogs. I'm interested in what you think about this. So I am going to be an English gent and let you roll with this one to start with.
I love dogs. I loved it. Loved it. I love Wes Anderson. I think his films are pure and utter brilliance. I mean, from Moonrise Kingdom to what was that? Oh gosh, I really wish I could remember the name of that hotel movie that he did.
The Darjeeling Limited?
Yes, that one right there. And now Isle of Dogs and Fantastic Mr. Fox. Honestly, though, I think Fantastic Mr. Fox is a better movie. I think Isle of Dogs is more technically masterful than Fantastic Mr. Fox. Isle of Dogs, I love this movie. Once again, from beginning to end, for the most part, I think there was some stuff with the language barrier I wish they had fixed. I enjoy having subtitles on screen. So when a character is speaking their native language and I don't have subtitles to kind of explain to me what's going on for a few minutes on screen, that kind of bothers me and takes me out of the movie and makes me realize I'm watching a movie instead of experiencing it. And there were a couple of characters here and there in the film that I thought could have easily just been taken out and the film would have been no different. Like, already talked about her once, Greta Gerwig. You know, Greta Gerwig, she's not only a director, she's an actress, and she's a brilliant actress. And she did a great job with Lady Bird. Honestly, her character in this particular movie, I felt if you took her out, the movie wouldn't be any different, even though I love Greta Gerwig to pieces. But as a whole, the maturity that Wes Anderson goes into when it comes to his films, and the maturity that he went into when it comes to Isle of Dogs, talking about friendship, talking about death, talking about life, essentially, is something that I really appreciate. I enjoy my kids' cartoon. It's true. I mean, I enjoy How to Train Your Dragon. I enjoy The Lion King. I enjoy all these good other films. Kinds of films. They're good films. And I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed Isle of Dogs. It's one of my favorite movies of this year. Again, it's in my top 10 of this year so far. It's a really, really great movie. But another problem I have with Isle of Dogs, I think the pacing wore on it just a little bit.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with everything you said there, apart from your opinion of the film. I didn't like this film.
What?
And I'm surprised by that because I love Wes Anderson's film. The Fantastic Mr. Fox is a sublime piece of work. That is a superb film. This film looks... This is probably the best stop-motion animation film that's ever been put to film, I think.
Yeah.
It looks incredible. And it plods along at a Wes Anderson pace. But for me, it was about 45 minutes too long. Like you say, the fact that you could take characters out of the film and it wouldn't even necessarily affect the story, to me, is a fairly big issue because what are they in there for? You've touched on the messages. There's nothing wrong with the messages. There's nothing wrong with how the film looked. I just think this could have been a short film, 45 minutes long, and I would have got much more of an impact, I think, from it. The voice acting was fantastic. Bryan Cranston and Liev Schreiber, Jeff Goldblum's humour and his repeated lines he kept saying, I enjoyed that. And the messages of fear, aggression, internal strife, they're quite surprising, very timely. But it just felt it went on for just too long. And I found myself becoming less interested as it went on. I was surprised by that because I went to see this film the morning it came out. Not even the day it came out, the morning it came out. I wasn't at work that day. And I went to about a 9 a.m. showing, which for me is early. So I went to see that, and I had high hopes for the film. But just this one, this is a rare time when the Wes Anderson film doesn't click for me, which is a shame because as a filmmaker, as an auteur, he is, he's unrivaled by, he's only rivaled by a few people. But yeah, sadly, Isle of Dogs, this didn't work for me. It was too long. The pacing was evident. I also wrote in my review that you could take Greta Gerwig's character out, not because she was bad, but it wouldn't impact the narrative or the story.
I mean, her character didn't really serve a purpose, in my opinion. And I mean, I see what you're saying. I mean, the movie is very, very slow at times, and there are portions of the movie that could be taken out. Me, it's just Wes Anderson is just one of those filmmakers. He's just so ballsy with what he does. Is that honestly, this is one of those films. I think The Fantastic Mr. Fox is one of those movies that you can take your kids to. I don't necessarily think parents should take their kids to go see Isle of Dogs. It's one of those films which that to me, I do think for me personally, that's a bonus because I do enjoy the more mature tones when it comes to film. But, you know, I just thoroughly loved Isle of Dogs. And unfortunately, we've reached our very first disagreement when it comes to this. And you know what?
It is, yeah.
I recommend it.
I, along with the... Strange, again, this is England, we don't do this, but the two people who walked out of this film in my screening, I can't recommend it. And that one really does, it is a strain to say, because it's a Wes Anderson film, and of course, everybody has their stumble, and it's all subjective, of course, but I so wanted to enjoy this film, and it looks so good. And the voice acting cast, we haven't even gone into that, because they're so good. But the film didn't grab me, so I am going to give it a thumbs down from me.
Oh, man. But,
we're talking about slow-paced films. The next film is slow-paced, but for me, it's the opposite.
Yeah, something tells me we're going to get into an argument on this one. Yeah. I can feel it coming. Because let me yeah, guys, if you couldn't already guess it, the next film we're talking about is, yeah, we're talking about Annihilation. And you know what, yep. Matt? Considering, I'm guessing you love this film, so I'm going to let you go first.
Yeah, I very much enjoyed this film. I really did. Again, there was an awful lot of hype coming out of this film from the festivals it was at. And also the fact that the United States got the wide release and the rest of the world, certainly the UK, it was just sort of unceremoniously dumped onto Netflix. Because I think Paramount assumed we're all too stupid to get it. But this is a slow-paced, highbrow, deep dive into humanity. It's just dripping with ambiguity. It looks visually beautiful at points. The sound design is out of this world. The pretty much always excellent Natalie Portman is, again, brilliant in this film. It benefits from having a fantastic supporting cast as well. Again, each getting their time to shine. What I didn't like was the final act. It disappointed me and I just didn't engage with it. Which is, I appreciate the message which bubbles away through the bizarreness. But I didn't enjoy the ending, which is funny, which is for a film which kind of pushes the boundaries of any realism, that ending just for me pushed it over it, which is a shame because I think it was a pretty ballsy move to end the film in this way. But it's intelligent, you need to engage your brains. This is one of those films. It's definitely more adventure than action, but even that can be classed as a stretch. It's probably more mystery, and there is a few scenes in this film which will have you off, which had me on the absolute edge of my seat. One involved a strange bear type creature and another one involved a knife and a navel. So if you have a weak heart, you may struggle with some of the scenes. But Annihilation poses the question, you know, is death or annihilation the end? Is it the beginning? Is it something in between? What it does do is it challenges you to not try and think about it afterwards. So with that high praise, over to Cody.
Yeah, with that high praise, yeah, you know, the film may ask the questions of is death or annihilation the end. It may have good performances, which, look, the points that you made, I'm not arguing against. The movie looks great. You know, the director of this film, Ex Machina, was one of my favorite films the year that it came out. It was brilliant. This film, I felt, was just a way bigger step down. Look, the questions that they asked about humanity, yeah, they're important. But do I think they needed to be asked in this fashion? No, I don't necessarily think so. Because honestly, the film, for the most part for me, it was long, it was boring. Yeah, I get the messages that the director was trying to get across, but I felt they were a little bit too preachy. And the whole idea of the film, the whole concept of the film, the way it unfolded, I was not a big fan of. You know, some of the images in the film, yes, they do shock, and they're there. I admit those scenes, they're important and they need to be there. But the slow paced scenes, you know, in Ex Machina, it seemed like the reason why I could get into it is there was always this string of revelation that was continually being processed, or these questions that were always being asked. In Annihilation, I never felt that way. Yeah, there were certain points at the beginning, middle, and end of the film, every part of the film, where I thought there were little tiny pieces of revelation being revealed, especially at the end. But throughout the entire film, I felt there were long segments. Long, dull, boring segments that made me just want to check out of the movie theater because I was just not enjoying what I was watching. I enjoy the deep thinking movies, guys. You've heard me praise Blade Runner 2049, but this film, you know, I understood. I literally waited. I gave my review on first glance about it. I analyzed it. But I gave myself like a period of 2 months to fully think about the film. And I just did not like it. It's one of those things. I understand why people like it because it is a deeper, it is a thinking person's movie. But man, this film, I mean, this is the film this year. I think this film is insanely overrated.
I totally respect your opinion because you bring up the valid points. And I do agree about Ex Machina. I do think that is a better film because the first time I saw Ex Machina, I didn't particularly like it. But then I went back and rewatched it and realised that I'm an idiot. And it's fantastic. And yeah, I agree that how that unravels, there seems to be more of an urgency about it. And Annihilation, you know, I'm not going to sugarcoat it, does have moments in it where it does seem to be a lot of nothing happening, kind of like the Hostiles effect, where you know you should be taking it all in, but there are times when not that much is going on, which again begs the question, could it have been cut from the overall end of the film? But there was something I enjoyed the vast majority of it. Like I mentioned, like the epically mental finale just didn't work for me. It really took me out, and I know this is a sci-fi film. You can expect the unexpected at times, but that level of just bizarreness just really took me out of the film. And it was to a detriment of what came before, because I enjoyed the five badass females tooled up going into the Shimmer, which also I didn't like the name of the Shimmer. But I also said if Stephen King called it the Shimmer, it would somehow sound right. But I liked the idea of the five women just going in with their own special skills, not like Liam Neeson, tooled up, to, you know, ready to take on whatever's in there. I liked that.
You know, that was good.
But there are scenes that didn't work for me, yeah.
You know, when it comes to this movie, it's like you said, the third act, honestly, when it comes to science fiction, I was raised on Star Trek in films like Star Trek. Blade Runner 2049, I loved. Looking for the unexpected, it's going to happen in sci-fi. But at a certain point, when something is so unexpected for the sake of shock value, which that's what I feel the ending of this movie was, it was unexpected and it was overly unexpected for the sake of shock value. And I did not like it at all.
Yeah, I agree with that. For as much as I thought the film was very good, I didn't like the ending. And I know there are lots of people I respect and other fellow film critics like ourselves out there who absolutely dug the ending. But for me, for somebody who was enjoying what I was watching, it really blew me out of the film big time, which is a shame because had that ending hit its target for me, it could have been up there in my top 10. Where it lands at the end of the year, I will be surprised to see, because I think at the minute it is in my top 20 at the minute, but once the end of the year comes and we've all seen hundreds of films, I'll be interested to see where it lands then. But for now, it's in there. I liked it. It's an intelligent sci-fi movie. It had many flaws compared to Garland's last film, Ex Machina. It didn't hit those heights. But for me, I did enjoy this film for the vast majority. So I would say, again, as we've now seen, it's not for everybody for different reasons. But I would recommend this film for at least a watch. If you can catch it on Netflix, check it out.
You know what? Here's the funny thing. I'm going to 360 this entire thing. I did not like Ex Machina. I thought the performances were good. The visuals were beautiful. And, you know, I thought the script was decent. I hated everything else pretty much. The ending, the middle, the beginning. All of it, I just did not like it. However, I will recommend it because here's the thing. Even though I did not like Ex Machina, like I said, this is a thinking person's movie. And not Ex Machina, Annihilation. Annihilation, I loved Ex Machina. Annihilation, this film is very much like Ex Machina, to where I think I can't be the one to actually say whether I recommend it or not. For me personally, I think it is a decision that needs to be on everybody else, whether they like it or not. Because me, I have my own personal opinion. But like I said, that was after months of thinking about this movie after I saw it. So for me personally, I recommend it because I want you to have your own opinion about the movie and see what you think after doing a couple of months of thinking about it.
And that's absolutely fair. So we kind of have 1.5 recommendations there, I'd probably hasten to say. I would recommend it, and Cody kind of recommends it. Is that fair to say? Well, it's not an absolute endorsement.
I mean, it's not an absolute. For me personally, it's not a full endorsement, no. But it is an endorsement to watch it once. So you can actually so that whoever watches it can come up with their own opinion on whether they like the film or they don't.
Yeah, that's fair enough. It is another one of the buzzwords. It's a divisive film.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Whether it meant to be or not, it is. Yeah, one and a half slash two recommendations, if not just for the intrigue factor. From highbrow to something completely different next.
Yep. All right, guys. We're moving on to comedies once again. And okay, if you ask me, this is another example of why I don't think comedies are actually taking a backslide this year. It is low comedy. It is very raunchy. And that is the movie Blockers. Obviously, it's a film about a group of parents whose daughters are deciding they want to lose their virginity on prom night. And what I'll say about this movie, what I can say about it is very lowbrow humor. Granted, I do have some major problems with the movie. However, the one thing I want a comedy to do is make me laugh. And Blockers did inevitably make me laugh for a good portion of it. I do think that it is a very good comedy, even though it doesn't do what Game Night does. I don't exactly think that it does flow between every different kind of form of comedy you can find. I think it does generally stay in the more lower brow section because we are talking about teenagers having sex and losing their virginity. So it does tend to stay more lowbrow humor. What I'll say, though, John Cena, this guy is a comedic star. Leslie Mann, I thought, oh my goodness, all the parents in this movie, and all the parents were great. But you know, the people who shocked me the most in this movie, when it came to their chemistry and their performances, were all the teenagers. Were all the people portraying teenagers? Because everybody in this movie, very much like with Game Night, they all have very, very good chemistry. This movie is very funny, even though it's very lowbrow. I mean, this movie is definitely not going to be for everybody. I mean, the movie is very raunchy. It is very raunchy. But me, I got a lot of laughs out of it. My only problem is the message that the film was trying to teach, I don't exactly think was very appropriate. I understand what they were trying to say, but I don't exactly think it's a message that we should be teaching teenagers.
Yeah, I enjoyed this film. What I will say about it is I found it to be a comedy that isn't all that funny. And what I mean by that was I enjoyed it, but I didn't find it to be laugh out loud funny.
Yeah.
I wasn't sitting there rolling around in my seat. But there were certain moments which were fantastic. Part of that was due to how good Ike Barinholtz, Leslie Mann and John Cena were. John Cena is very good now as that kind of, you know, softy in a tough guy shell. He's sort of creeping up and becoming surprisingly good in these kind of roles. Yeah, in terms of the message, I mean, Yeah, I mean, the message, it's a strange message, because in one way it's kind of empowering the independence, you know, being able to, for the parents to let go and realise that, you know, their kids need to be themselves and they need to live their own life. On the flip side of that, by doing that, mistakes happen and bad things can happen, which you may not want to happen at a certain time of your life. So there is a strange sort of disparity in that message. For the most part, I found it a surprisingly decent message when you think about it in the positive light. The movie does have its moments. There are moments that have you kind of giggling a bit, and there are the usual gross out moments that come in these kind of films. And there's enough here that will keep me entertained. And it is better than I thought it would be. I didn't have any expectations at all for this film, and it didn't have me rolling around the floor.
Yeah,
but I did enjoy it. Where I thought it fell flat was as it went further and further on. The high drinks all got a bit too over the top and a little bit less authentic, and it started to get a bit too far, which is at odds, because in between that you've got sort of softer moments in between that, between the parents, which is then superseded by up in the ante with these antics of theirs. But, you know, the balance isn't brilliant, but the film is pretty good. It's okay.
I mean, it's something I found interesting, because there is one scene in particular, my favorite performance out of everybody, out of the parents. I love John Cena, but for me, I think Leslie Mann stole the show, and it's for one particular scene near the end of the movie. There is this one scene involving Leslie Mann. I'm not going to get into spoilers, because this scene made the entire movie for me. There's a scene involving Leslie Mann at the end of the movie. It had me rolling over in laughter. I didn't do that much throughout the movie, but there's one scene near the end of the movie that got me pretty good.
Is that the scene where she's trying to be inconspicuous, shall we say?
Yes.
Yes,
yes,
I know what you mean. Yes, that is, again, that those kind of scenes, they can either be very funny or be a bit, you know, cringy. It's all about how it's acted, and Leslie Mann is very good at what she does.
Yeah, so I know for me, look, the movie has very lowbrow humor, and although it didn't make me laugh as hard as Game Night, and although I don't think it's as good as a movie of Gay Night, it's probably not one of the best movies of the year, I still think it's a good comedy that has some very good laughs in it. So honestly, it's going to depend on who you are, because not everybody can handle a lot of raunch related comedy. But me, I think if it's done in a certain way, I think it can be funny, and Blockers made me laugh. So I do recommend it, depending on who you are.
Yep, I didn't have any expectations. I enjoyed the film. It wasn't as funny as I'd hoped it was, but it certainly wasn't boring. It's a great movie to check out again. Pizza, drink of choice on a chilled out Saturday evening. Sit back and enjoy it and just have a bit of fun. Again, you may not remember it in a few days' time, or a week or two, or by the end of the year. But when you watch it, you'll probably enjoy it. It's good fun. I'd recommend it. I'm saying it now. Check it out. Enjoy it. So 2 out of 2 for Blockers.
Okay. You know what? Here's the funny thing. The next film we are talking about, you will have to speak your opinion on, because I have not seen Veronica.
Yeah, well, this one I put in as kind of a, sort of penciled it in as a case of, well, it's not one that necessarily has to be spoken about, because it was released in the UK, in most markets, on Netflix. In its country of origin, I believe it was given a cinematic release. But Veronica, it's and the reason why I mention it is because when it came out, the buzz surrounding it was, this is the scariest movie you're going to see this year, this decade, even your lifetime, people were saying. I'm a horror fan. I love the old classic, and I like to be scared senseless. So what? And Paco Plaza directs this, and he also directed some of my favourite foreign films, in Wreck. Those films scared the living bejesus out of me. But this is a horror film. It's a Spanish horror film, so if you can handle your subtitles, check it out. But, you know, it doesn't boast anything that hasn't been seen before, but it just feels a bit fresher and on a slightly higher level than recent offerings, for a variety of reasons. The acting, the atmosphere, and the momentum. And I find that foreign horrors, or non-English speaking horrors, are very good at doing that. Paco Plaza, he's crafted a focus horror story. It's drawn from a 1991 Velázquez case, which is the first ever case in Spanish police history where paranormal activity was listed on the official police report as having been witnessed by a police officer. So in this police report, in the real world, in real life, a police officer has stated that he witnessed paranormal activity in an official police case, you know, which could be used as actual evidence. So the idea that, you know, some of these events could possibly have happened, if you believe all that, only kind of helps. But it isn't the scariest movie of all time. It isn't. It's probably not the scariest movie by Plaza himself. But there's more than enough here in the story and imagery to keep you away from a Ouija board for a long time. Sandra Askasena is excellent in her first ever film. It's the lead role. She's fantastic. She brings a real sense of vulnerability and desperation to her performance. It's got a superb introduction, which really, really sets the stall out. Once the introduction starts, it throws you around. You think, right, where are we going from here? Because it just throws you in the middle of something and takes you right back out again. So, in a nutshell, Veronica is creepy. It's a compelling horror movie that will have you checking around the house before you go to bed, just in case there's any evil out there. But it's a return to the sort of a claustrophobic horror films, which Plaza is good known for. For me, it's a great horror film. It's great or estupendo in any language. So if you can handle, and I mean that in a nice way, if you can handle films with subtitles and a horror film, which again can be quite slow burning at times, then by all means, check out Veronica. It should be on Netflix in your markets. If it is and you have time, check it out. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did.
Well, it looks
that's
like
my
a
Spanish movie bit.
I mean, it looks like I've got a movie to watch, that's for sure.
Yeah. And I hope you enjoy it as well, because I didn't enjoy all of it. There were some parts which, again, took me out of the film and I thought I could have done without that. But for the most part, I really enjoyed this film.
I mean, I'm a fan of horror. I'm a fan of slow burn horror. The Witch is one of my all-time favorite horror movies. Yeah. But now, it looks like we got our last movie in the month of March. And the last movie of this podcast episode. Let's talk about Love, Simon. And also, it's my favorite. It is my favorite coming-of-age story since Lady Bird. I don't like it as much as The Edge of 17. It's right in between Lady Bird and The Edge of 17 for me, but still, that is great. Love, Simon, for me, was a it's a very deep and personal story. And, you know, the thing that I love that movie screenwriters and directors and producers are doing now is they're not afraid to allow the teenagers to talk the way they talk. Kids are going to be vulgar. Kids are going to curse. Kids are going to say stuff that they wouldn't say around their parents. And they do the same thing here. And Love, Simon was a deeply, deeply moving movie, and I absolutely loved it.
I'm glad you mentioned The Edge of 17, because in terms of recent coming-of-age stories, that's also my favourite. I adored that film. But Love, Simon is a very, 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 very close second. And I think we're going to end this podcast both on the same opinion here. But it could have easily been another coming-of-age movie. And let's be fair, at times it is. You know, the story is, you know, there's nothing you haven't seen before. But that doesn't matter, because the performances and the story, the message, this film could not have been made 10 or 15 years ago. It just wouldn't. It's a testament to where we are now, that this film, with its message of having a gay lead character in a romantic film, coming-of-age story, can be released with a fanfare. And that's testament to the way the film was written and to Nick Robinson's superb performance in the lead role. But like I say, I mean, there's stuff you've seen before, you know, teens harbouring issues, the parents are cool, you know, the friends are all extremely very chic and very hip. You know, everybody lives in nice houses. The high school, certainly from an English point of view, looks very nice. But underneath it, yeah, it's a really charming and tender love story. It wouldn't matter what orientation the characters are, this would still be a pleasing story. But the fact that the lead character is a gay young man really just, you know, hits home that this is an important, important film.
Yeah, I mean, it's an important film. The performances all around, they're great. One of my favorite aspects of this film is the screenplay. The way this film was written, it's so well written. It's kind of ridiculous. And this is one of those, I mean, obviously this is based off of a book. So honestly, I don't know about anybody else, but for me personally, this is one of those screenplays that I don't think there's going to be another adapted screenplay that tops this, unless it's like super fantastic. But I'm thinking that the screenplay that we got for Love, Simon, I think we're going to see it at the Best Adapted Screenplay nominations next year, because the screenplay for Love, Simon, you know, the story and everything inside it was great. And one of the biggest reasons is, besides the performances and the way it was directed, is the way the dialogue and the scenes were written. The way this whole film was adapted from such a small book into such a powerful movie, it's brilliantly well done.
Yeah, one of the things I really liked is how they didn't kind of accentuate the fact that Simon was gay or pity him. It was so well written that, you know, it didn't feel, that aspect didn't fall into any kind of generic or cliche performance. So I thought that was fantastically written. And I agree, the screenplay for this was brilliant. One of the things I do find odd, and this is kind of almost off the record, not even a negative, but I still find it odd when I see things, modern foibles like FaceTime or drive-through coffee shops, Grindr, and things like Facebook being mentioned in films. It always makes me think, cool, I'm not used to that, because the films, obviously, I'm used to seeing, the references are older. So seeing these sort of hyper-modern references always makes me, I always find it quite strange. But anyway, that's nothing to do with this film. It's just something which I always find odd. But everything you say, true. It's just awesome to see a movie like this where everybody comes together in celebration. And, you know, for a while, the world doesn't seem like such a bad place after seeing this film. I came out of this film with such a big grin on my face, because it just made me feel brilliant.
I mean, yeah. If there's one thing, I say this in my review too, is the one of the bigger reasons why I love Simon is because this film is a perfect representation about the celebration of life. It's a perfect representation of putting aside your differences and loving people just for who they are. I mean, of course, there's always going to be those jerks out there who judge you no matter what you do or what you say, but this film is just a perfect representation of what our world could be, even though it's not that way now. And I mean, it's brilliant, because it's not a film, even though we follow a main character who's gay, it's not a film that actually is preachy about it, because there are those films out there. It's a film that teaches, you know, we got one character who's gay. We got all of his friends around him. They're just high school kids. You know, they've got their whole relational issues, but they're high school. They, you know, they're dealing with homework, with extracurricular activities. It doesn't matter what their sexual orientation is. This is just a representation of life. This is a representation of who these people are. And Love, Simon, you know, ever since the age of 17, this is my favorite interpretation of, oh, and The Breakfast Club.
Of course.
But of course, The Breakfast Club is probably my all-time favorite coming-of-age film. But, I mean, Love, Simon, I can't really say any more than that. Love, Simon it's one of my favorite films of this year. It's just so good.
Yeah, it's in my top five already, and I can imagine it's gonna hover around there. And just like the film says, Simon is just like the rest of us. That's just how it is. It's a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant film. Everything considered, it was a joy to watch, and it will have you beaming by the end of it. So yeah, I can't think of enough adjectives to describe the film. It's two thumbs up. It's fantastic. I highly recommend this film if you haven't seen it.
Yeah, it's great. And it looks like we've reached the end. I think that is the end of all the movies we're going to talk about for this quarter.
And it was a mixed bag. And you know what's the best part of it? We didn't just say, yep, I agree, let's both have the same opinion.
Yeah.
Towards the end, there were films where we don't agree. And that's good. That's how it should be. It would be very boring if we agreed in every film.
And you know what? Here's the thing. This is the thing I love. Because unlike certain people and certain groups of people who are very passionate about films, On the YouTube space and in the world today, we were actually, for the films that we disagreed on, we were able to have a civil conversation about that. And that's the beauty of this whole thing.
And that's how it should be as well. We're doing a podcast about movies. Cody has a channel, I have a website. We love films. We are passionate about films, but we're also not idiots. We're human beings who understand that not everybody is drawn to the same things. And everybody out there, listen to me and Cody, because we'll show you how to do it. But I tell you something, quarter two, some of the films, Infinity War, Quiet Place, Solo, Deadpool 2, Jurassic Park, Fallen Kingdom, that's just some of the films that's going to be in the next episode.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm so excited because I've already talked about some of those films on my channel, and I'm so excited for us to have our next episode in a few months here, because this year, although it's been a rough start, I'm hoping that this episode was educational. I'm hoping that all of you who are listening, you got some recommendations for some films you can watch. And I'm hoping that some of the words that we've said here, I'm hoping that you can take some of the stuff that we've said here about the films we've talked about.
Yeah, absolutely. If we can get some of you guys to at least check out some of the films which you may not have particularly wanted to see or have any interest in, whether you like it or not, you know, if we can influence you to check a couple out, then that's great. If you have seen any of the films which we've recommended and you like them, let us know, because, you know, it's good to hear. But like Cody said, that is that for this episode of the Movie Quarter. Because we started this podcast later on in the year, we will be back in a month's time, obviously, all things being well, to cover the second quarter, which will be April to June, before giving ourselves 3 months off to take a breath, catch that third quarter of the year, and then come back even stronger. But it's been great talking movies again, Cody. I really enjoyed this. But where can the world find you talking about movies on the internet?
Of course, guys. All right. So if you want to find me, number one, you can find me on my social media platforms, which are both Twitter and Instagram. You can find me at @_Cody_Curtis. But more importantly, you can find me on YouTube at Cody Curtis. Just search the name CodyCurtis. Should be the first name that pops up. Not only making movie reviews and movie analysis, but me and my good buddy, Zach Pope. Let me say that again. Zach Pope, go check out his channel as well, because him and I, we've kind of started doing some major projects. We've got our own podcast, which is up. It's called the Sweet Life Podcast. No, not Sweet Life, Sweet Film Podcast, where we talk about movies with some friends of ours. We talk about everything up and down when it comes to movies that are either coming up or movies that we love or appreciate or just overall our passion. And we've got some pretty big stuff headed your guys' way, and we're super excited to bring it to you. So other than that, that's where you guys can find me. And more importantly, that's where you can also find my buddy Zach Pope, because at this point we're pretty much partners in crime.
It's like Batman and Robin, but only if Robin was a bit cooler than he is in the film. So, but go check out Cody's work. He's kind of spelled it out for you there, what you can expect to see. It's informative, it's entertaining. It can be brief, concise, but it can also be detailed. So, whatever you're looking for from a review, you're probably going to find it there. So, go check it out. You can find me, if you're after that, at whatiwatchtonight.co.uk. Search for What I Watch Tonight on Twitter and Instagram, and you'll find us. In terms of finding this show, iTunes, check it out. Subscribe on iTunes. You'll get every episode of the Movie Quarter on there. But you'll also get this show on Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Podknife, and eventually YouTube. Just audio only, thankfully. You won't have to put up with my face. So if you do like what you hear, share the episodes and tell the world and tell us. You know, there's nothing better than being told what a good job you do. And if you don't like the shows, probably best keep it to yourself. So from me, it's goodbye. And from Cody,
I hope you all have a fantastic rest of your day.
Game.